Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 116, The Odyssey by Homer, as translated by Emily Wilson.
After years of war, no one could stand between my men.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast that is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature we have both read and determine whether it is required reading. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Tom Panarese, and I'm never cool enough to be Odysseus, so I'm searching places in search of my father, and accompanying me is my mentor, Stella.
Hello.
How are you?
How lovely. I'm doing well. Mm. I could see myself as an Athena sort of person.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Even though I have some questions of her actions, but we'll...
Yeah, we could talk about Athena.
Yeah.
So, how are you?
I'm doing okay. Yeah, I feel revived after I didn't go to Greece, but I did go to Italy. So I felt, you know, somewhat of a connection there. And yeah, looking forward to, you know, now that we're getting pretty close to the film, people are asking what I'm thinking about it. And I am getting slightly worried, to be honest.
Yeah.
mainly because of, I'm just worried about how they're going to present Odysseus, because I think he is not at times very unlikable. And I hope that we don't just, like, because it's Matt Damon, decide that we need to make him like this glorious man and always be sympathetic and all that. So I do worry.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah. We're recording this, by the way, on July 9th. The movie comes out next Friday, which is July 16th. I've had reservations since Matt Damon was announced as being cast, because I was like, that man does not look Greek. But at the same time, it's a Christopher Nolan movie. So there's a certain amount of benefit of the doubt that I'll give Nolan when it comes to this sort of stuff. So yeah, I'm kind of curious as to how he's going to be portrayed and how this is going to be portrayed. So, which is a little bit of a kind of a teaser, because this is part one of a two-part crossover. We did this a couple of years ago with the movie, with 12th Night, and then the movie She's the Man, and we're doing it here. So we're going to be talking about the Odyssey, the epic poem by Homer, on this episode of this show. And then in a couple of weeks after this show comes out, we'll release an episode of Pop Culture Affidavit, which is my other podcast, and that will be Stella and I talking about the Christopher Nolan movie. We're both going to go see it in the next week or so when it comes out, and then we're going to sit down and kind of do our impressions of it, whether or not we thought it was a good movie to begin with, how, and then as an adaptation, how the characters are portrayed, et cetera, et cetera. So I will make sure that I post that to the Facebook page and stuff when it comes out. So, but let's get into the book. this is not exactly an obscure piece of literature, and I want to say we probably both have a history with this book. So, Stella, what is your experience with the Odyssey?
Yeah, I feel like it started when I was young, at least in terms of knowing about Odysseus and the Cyclops in particular. And then in Latin in high school, I'm sure I was more aware of the actual story. But the first time I read the Odyssey, which I could not even tell you what the translation was. I do recall what it looked like. I got it from the UVA library. It was one of those like university sort of bindings. It was a short, squat, red book. It didn't even say the Odyssey on the front of it. It's just kind of one of those typical one. I think I am not describing it well, but I feel like if you go to the stacks and it's like an old book, like, you know, translated from the 40s or something, you'll know exactly what I mean. And the reason why is because I had a job interview. So this was my fifth year in college, about to graduate, a job interview at the school in Lynchburg, Virginia. And I remember talking to the principal about like linguistics, and she mentioned the Odyssey and had, I don't recall why, but we were talking about it. And she asked if I had ever read, and I said, not fully. And so I figured, which I did have a callback, what are those called? A second interview. And I remember before that, I ended up reading both the Odyssey as well as this linguistics book that she had mentioned, potentially thinking that it would give me a leg up. But I think it was also like, oh, you know, then I can have something to discuss with this person. So that was the first time that I had read the Odyssey. Okay. And then I brought it into, it was in the ninth grade curriculum at my previous school, but I wanted to also sort of lay the groundwork for that, and ended up having sections of it in eighth grade because there were translations in the book that dealt with him. So I thought, oh, this will be a nice overlap. I ended up switching that to the Aeneid because I felt like maybe it was too much happening. So I reread it, which I think was Fagles, I believe. And that was the last time that I had read it fully. And then, so that was in like the 2010s of some sort. And then got this because someone gave me a gift card for an independent bookstore around me. And I thought, well, I'm finally, because of course the first one I got, well, of hers was the Iliad, because, you know, I have a preference for that. But I thought, well, now I've got, you know, this gift card, I'm going to go and get the Odyssey by Emily Wilson, because that's really what I wanted. And so this is, I guess, the third time that I'm reading it in full.
Okay.
And I should say that, oh my gosh, this is a huge gap. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
The Armand Asante made for TV film when I was in elementary school. Cause I was not, I don't know, maybe fifth grade.
It was 97, I believe, is when it came out.
So I remember still being in Buffalo at the time, but I loved that film. Taped it, you know, and did the whole pause when there's a commercial break, you know, with the VCR. Isabel Rossellini Vanessa Williams. I mean, that cast was amazing. So I feel like that was really formative as well. So yeah, that was even before the Latin. So that is how I would have known about him. So there you go. And the bloodbath that was.
Yeah. Yeah. I have it on DVD.
Oh.
I love it as well. Yeah. Bernadette Peters played Circe. Oh,
yes.
Eric Roberts played Antinous and had this like really terrible mullet the entire time. But no, the whole thing, I've shown it in class. So with me, we did the Iliad a couple years ago, and that really was my introduction to Homer. I think I'd have probably heard of Odysseus and the Odyssey here and there over the years, but I was never a huge Greek mythology person. You know, we did kind of a unit or two here and there in like elementary school. It wasn't until 2005 when I first read the Odyssey ever. not even in excerpts, but because I was about to start teaching. I started teaching in the fall of 2005. And in addition to journalism and the yearbook, I was teaching what they called ninth grade workshop, which was essentially like remedial ninth grade English. And on the curriculum were excerpts from the Odyssey, mostly like the wanderings of Odysseus part, you know, Polyphemus and Circe, et cetera. So having never read it, I went out and bought it. I bought the Fagles translation. I actually still have my copy. And actually really, really liked it because I went in thinking this is going to be a chore because, as I said in the Iliad episode, I hated the Iliad when I was in college. So, and Emily Wilson's translation redeemed it for me. So I read it entirely in the Fagles. I taught it 1 year, and then I did not really approach it again until I started teaching where I am now in 2017, because I started teaching ninth grade again after years of teaching 10th. And this was like around the time the Wilson translation came out. I think it might have been the same year or a year before it. So I bought the Wilson translation in hardcover, and it actually just sat on my shelf for a while. I read bits and pieces of it because we were using it here and there. But by and large, the Robert Fitzgerald translation was what we had been using at my school because we had it was in the textbook and we had like 300 copies of it. So I haven't read all of the Fitzgerald translation, just like what we would use. So we would use parts of the first four books, books 9 through 12, and then like bits and pieces and 21, and you know, like the bloodbath at the end and everything. I did show them the movie, either excerpts or the whole thing. They actually liked it more than I realized they would, because I thought, oh, they're going to think this is like cheesy special effects and stuff. But no, I think it holds up incredibly well, and they were like really entertained. I finally sat down and read the Emily Wilson translation and started it. And I'm not kidding when I say I finished like the back half of it in a weekend, because I just kept going. And granted, at that point, I've been teaching it for several years. So I knew like by heart what happens in certain parts of it. So reading those parts was easy. But no, I read it like really, really quickly. I still teach excerpts from it. I'm doing more of a mythology focus unit this year as opposed to just an Odyssey unit. But I will bring in that. And I reread it for this episode. And so it is the third time I've reread it. I've read it in its entirety. So, yeah. When it comes to Homer and the history of the Odyssey, I pulled a lot of the information I have for this section from Wilson's book, because Wilson has a really long introduction, as well as a translator's note. And if you read it and you want to kind of like dive a little deeper into like her process and her thoughts in the Odyssey, it's really, really worth reading. So I just kind of hit some highlights here because like it's an extensive look at the bio of Homer, the history of the Odyssey, what certain aspects of Greek culture are there, and then like how she approached the translation, et cetera, et cetera. So when it comes to Homer, Wilson says that the authorship of Homer's poems is complex and difficult because these texts emerged from an oral tradition. She goes into the history of that oral tradition as well, noting that much of the world of Homer was illiterate because it was during the time of what was called the Greek Dark Ages. Prior to this period, the Mycenaean Greek civilization collapsed. It's referred to very often as the Late Bronze Age collapse. She said that you know, they're still kind of archaeologically uncovering reasons for it. Could have been, you know, civilization collapsing in on itself, foreign invaders, disease, climate change, those sorts of things. But there was an enormous amount of things lost, including early written language. So the oral tradition arises, and in her introduction, Wilson discusses how the presence of poets in the Odyssey, most notably Demodocus, who is in book 8, suggests that Homer is honoring that tradition, like by bringing forth this idea that these stories are told rather than written down. She notes that Homer, supposedly the blind poet, right? You know, there's even a statue of him at the end of the lawn at the University of Virginia in front of Old Cabell Hall.
Yes. Well, yeah, because you got it when you run naked, you got to keep the lawn, you have to touch his feetsies, and then you run back up. And it's hard because the lawn is, tiered.
Yes.
The slide going down, but on the way up, you're like, the elevation is increasing. And yeah, you're probably intoxicated, this whole thing.
And it's and if it's slightly wet.
Oh my gosh. You're gonna bite it.
So anyway, she notes that Homer, who was a supposedly blind poet, was considered a poet and not a rhapsode. Rhapsodes were the people who often told the stories. Most of what we know of the Odyssey actually is based on medieval manuscripts. And since there's some speculation and mystery about the authorship of these epics, there's what Wilson refers to as the Homeric question. How did this come about? How real were the events and who were the composers? It's a question that's been debated ever since the rediscovery of Homer during the Renaissance. And you could go down a whole rabbit hole with regard to academia of people who literally study Homer, the poets, the literature of ancient Greece and Rome, basically classicists, right? And kind of there's all, in addition to criticizing and looking at the literature, there's also, like I said, like an archaeological aspect to this where you are finding out more as they continue to explore, like, where is and what is all of this stuff. As for the when the Odyssey was kind of created, in a sense, the general consensus, Wilson says, it's about a 100-year period, approximately, sometime between the mid-8th century BCE and the late 7th century BCE. So, again, like, kind of a wide range, but when it's so old and you don't have, like, the written record that you would say, like, the Brits do as when you're talking about, like, the Canterbury Tales or something, you know, you're doing your approximation. It does predate, like, most of the Greeks that we know in terms of writing. The philosophers like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, and people like Sophocles, etc. Emily Wilson herself, this is her bio from her website. Emily Wilson is the department chair and professor of classical studies at the University of Pennsylvania, holding the College for Women class of 1963 term professor in the humanities. Wilson attended Oxford University. She has a BA in classics and master's in philosophy and Renaissance English literature, as well as a PhD in classics and comparative literature from Yale. She's been named a fellowship of the American Academy in Rome in Renaissance and Early Modern Scholarship, a MacArthur Fellow, and a Guggenheim Fellow. She's published 4 books on ancient literature, philosophy, and translation. She's edited a volume on tragedy, and she's also published many essays and articles, as well as verse translations of Seneca, Sophocles, Euripides, and, of course, both Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. This, by the way, came out before her translation of the Iliad. Just in case anybody, like, the Iliad translation came out a couple years ago. This came out in 2017, and she lives in Philadelphia. So her translation was released in 2017 to a degree of fanfare because she was credited as the first woman to translate the book. She wrote a thorough translator's note that really gets into the weeds about her methodology. But one of the bigger highlights is that she changed the meter of the poem from dactylic hexameter to iambic pentameter, mainly because of iambic pentameter's legacy in English language literature. She talks about making the language less academic and more accessible to a wide audience, really saying that, like, you know, these poems were written and recited for everyone and weren't just some sort of, like, you know, kind of, there wasn't much of a barrier to the storytelling that sometimes academia places on certain things. Anyway, and that's me, a little conjecture on my part. So she also mentions that she restrained herself to the exact length of the epic, as it has the same number of lines as her source material. The translator's note ends with some words on what the Odyssey is about. And I really like the way she phrased this, so I'm going to go ahead and read it, the last two paragraphs of her translation note. The Odyssey is a very ancient and very foreign text. Although its long-standing prominence in Anglo-American and European cultures may mask its strangeness, Homer's concerns with loyalty, families, migrants, consumerism, violence, war, poverty, identity, rhetoric, and lies are in many ways deeply familiar, but we see them here in unfamiliar guises. The poem is concerned above all with the duties and dangers involved in welcoming foreigners into one's home. I hope my translation will enable contemporary readers to welcome and host this foreign poem with all the right degrees of warmth, curiosity, openness, and suspicion. There's a stranger outside your house. He is old, ragged, and dirty. He is tired. He has been wandering, homeless, for a long time, perhaps many years. Invite him inside. You do not know his name. He may be a thief. He may be a murderer. He may be a god. He may remind you of your husband, your father, or yourself. Do not ask questions. Wait. Let him sit in a comfortable chair and warm himself beside your fire. Bring him some food, the best you have, and a cup of wine. Let him eat and drink until he is satisfied. Be patient. When he is finished, he will tell his story. Listen carefully. It may not be as you expect. So, like I said, I really like the way that that is there. The other thing, by the way, in the book, between the translator note and the actual text of the Odyssey are three maps. You have the world of the Odyssey, which looks at just kind of the greater Mediterranean. You have mainland Greece and then the Peloponnese, which is kind of like a zoomed in thing. I always love maps and books. And I was the thing that, so with the world of the Odyssey actually shows you like where the various things are. I used to do like a modern world geography with the overlay of the Odyssey on it, like assignment, which is always kind of cool. And the thing that struck me was like, oh, the Sumerians are listed on here. So I'm like, is Conan the Barbarian involved? But I know he's not. So.
Oh, I didn't know he was a Sumerian.
Yeah. That's, so, okay.
Ancestors.
Yeah. So reception and reviews. The New York Times praised the translation's radically contemporary voice. Charlotte Higgins described Wilson's work as a cultural landmark that exposes centuries of masculinist translation. Poet and translator Josephine Balmer agreed in the statement that the previous translation had been firmly male. NPR's Annalisa Quinn described the translation as progressivist, excising centuries of verbal ideological buildup, citing previous translators' editions of Christianization, sexism, and Victorian euphemism. Colin Burrow of the London Review of Books described Wilson as a modernizer, particularly highlighting her translations of epithets into phrases that provide running commentary on emotional and social relationships. He also stated the immense challenges posed by retaining the same number of lines. Other critics have emphasized the traditional qualities of Wilson's poetic form, saying there's absolutely no more traditional music in the history of English literature. It was praised as an accessible introduction to the poem. And Madeline Miller, who wrote Song of Achilles, which was taken essentially out of the Iliad, and Circe, which is taken from the Odyssey, partially retelling it, praised the translation for retaining, quote, Homer's speed and narrative drive. Miller and Quinn highlighted Wilson's inclusion of the word slave, which has been traditionally translated as maids or servants. Essayist Wyeth Mason reported being floored by Wilson's alliterative, musical, and natural and subtle treatment of the poem's first lines. Other scholars criticized Wilson's translation as a deviation from the content of the original. South African scholar Richard Whitaker noted that, quote, the two great novelties of Wilson's Odyssey are the way she represents a group of characters that we might term underdogs, notably the Cyclops, the suitors, and their allies, in a sympathetic light, while representing Odysseus as, on balance, reprehensible. The big problem, however, is with Wilson's heterodox approach to the characters of the Odyssey is that she can sustain it only by distorting and misrepresenting what the Greek text says. He argued that Wilson makes no effort to overcome her obvious and personal but anachronistic biases. Okay. I don't think she's sympathetic to the suitors, but we could get into that later. She was the first woman to publish a complete translation of the Odyssey, although Barbara Leone Picard produced an English prose retelling for her children in 1952. But in 2019, Wilson says the media's emphasis on this presented her, quote, as unique in a way she is not unique. She highlighted other female scholars of Homer and that women had translated the poem into languages other than English before. There have been a number of adaptations. Classicist Edith Hall says the Odyssey has been regarded as the very birthplace of literary fiction. T.E. Lawrence wrote an introduction to the epic in 1932, saying it was the greatest novel ever written, and it's one of the oldest pieces of literature regularly read by Western audiences. Dante has Odysseus in the Inferno. He's in the eighth circle of hell. Odysseus appends a new ending to the epic in which he continues adventuring and does not return to Ithaca. Edith Hall says that Dante's depiction of Odysseus became understood as a manifestation of Renaissance colonialism and othering, with the Cyclops standing in for, quote, accounts of monstrous races on the edge of the world. And
what's
symbolized
the eighth circle?
I cannot remember.
Is it Pride?
Let's look it up. Fraud, which is interesting.
Because he's a liar.
I guess so. Some of Odysseus's adventures reappear in the Arabic tales of Sinbad the Sailor as well. Most notably, somebody who was influenced by the Odyssey was James Joyce, who wrote the modernist novel Ulysses. Joyce had encountered the figure in Odysseus in Charles Lamb's Adventures of Ulysses, which is an adaptation of the epic poem for children. And it established the Latin name in Joyce's mind because, of course, Ulysses is the Roman or Latin character name for Odysseus. Modern writers have revisited the Odyssey to highlight the poem's female characters, most notably Margaret Atwood, who adapted parts of the Odyssey for her novella The Penelopeiad in 2005, which focuses on Penelope and the 12 female slaves hanged by Odysseus at the poem's ending, which is an image that haunted Atwood. Atwood's novella comments on the original text wherein Odysseus' successful return to Ithaca entails the restoration of a patriarchal system. And of course, I already mentioned Circe by Madeline Miller. As a reader, Miller was frustrated by Circe's lack of motivation in the original poem and sought to explain her capriciousness. The novel portrays the sorceress's transformations of sailors into pigs from an act of malice into one of self-defense, influenced by her past experience with sexual predators. As far as music is concerned, it's been done in a number of operas. Il Ritorno di Ulisse in Patria, which was first performed in 1640, is by Claudio Monteverdi. Rolf Rehm composed an opera based on the myth called Sirenen Bilder des Berg... Sirens, Images of Desire and Destruction is the actual English translation, and that was a German opera that premiered in 2014. And there is a Robert Smith's Second Symphony for Concert Band, The Odyssey, tells four of the main highlights of the story, the Iliad, the Winds of Poseidon, the Isle of Calypso, and Ithaca. There's a ballet called Ulysses based on The Odyssey by Jean-Claude Galota, and then Epic, the Musical by Jorge Rivera-Heron. Tells the story of the Odyssey over the course of nine sagas, beginning with the end of the Trojan War and carrying through to Odysseus' homecoming in Ithaca. The book has been adapted into comic book or graphic novel form. I'm pretty sure it was probably a Classics Illustrated comic at one point. I meant to look that up and I didn't. The Marvel Comics kind of version of Classics Illustrated, which was the Marvel Classics Comics series from the late 70s, did an adaptation. The Odyssey is issue number 18 in 1977. The writer was Bill Mantlow. The artist was Jess M. Jodleman. The letterer was credited as Condoy. The colorist was Irene Vartanoff. I got that from Mike's Amazing World of Comics, by the way. The Odyssey graphic novel by Gareth Hinds was published in 2010. He also did one of Beowulf that I had at one point. The Odyssey miniseries in 2008, Marvel produced a 8-issue miniseries of The Odyssey written by Roy Thomas with pencils by Greg Tucchini, inks by Roland Paris, letters by Joe Caramanga, and the colorist was Arturo Fujita. And it has been adapted in a number of films, both foreign and American. L'Odissea is an Italian silent film by Giuseppe Di Liguro. Ulysses is an Italian film starring Kirk Douglas as Ulysses, Silvana Mangano as Penelope and Circe, and Anthony Quinn as Antinous. L'Odissea is an Italian, French, German, Yugoslavian television miniseries praised for his faithful rendering of the original epic. L'Odissea is from 1911. Ulysses is from 1954. L'Odissea was from 1968. Sorry, I meant to say the years. Ulysses 31 was from 81 and 82. It's a French-Japanese television animated series set in the futuristic 31st century. Nostos, The Return from 1989 is an Italian film about Odysseus' homecoming. It was directed by Franco Piavoli. It relies on visual storytelling and has a strong focus on nature. Ulysses Gaze from 1995, directed by Theo Angelopoulos, has many of the elements of the Odyssey set against the backdrop of the most recent and previous Balkan Wars. The miniseries we already mentioned, which aired, I believe, on NBC, was from 1997. It was directed by Andre Konchalovsky. It starred Oman DeSante as Odysseus. Greta Sacchi played Penelope. Isabella Rossellini was Athena. Vanessa Williams was Calypso. Bernadette Peters was Cersei, and I mentioned that Eric Roberts played Antonis. The effects by Christopher Lee played Tiresias. The effects by and large, I believe, were done by like the Jim Henson studio. And it's like Stella and I both said, we both really do like that. I mean, it does take a little bit of liberty with some of the events and such, but overall is a solid adaptation. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? This is a Coen Brothers film starring George Clooney, and it's loosely based on Homer's poem. The Return from 2024 is a film based on books 13 through 24, which is directed by Umberto Pasolini. It stars Ray Fiennes as Odysseus and Juliette Binoche as Penelope. And of course, as we've already mentioned, there is The Odyssey coming out this year. Next week, as we record this, directed by Christopher Nolan, based on the poem. Matt Damon is playing Odysseus. Anne Hathaway is Penelope. Tom Holland, I believe, is Telemachus. Is Zendaya playing Athena?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I think Charlize Theron is in it, as well as Lupita Nyong'o.
She's supposed to be Penelope. Oh, sorry.
Cersei or Calypso. I think she's Calypso. Yeah, so pretty well-known star-studded cast, and we'll be taking a look at that in a few weeks.
Yeah. I was disappointed because I thought Charlize Theron would be amazing as Athena, just because we were always talking about her being the gray-eyed goddess.
Mm-hmm.
And also because there is some, like, kind of flirtation between Odysseus and Athena, I feel a little uncomfortable with
Ooh, that's a good point.
I actually thought Zendaya was going to be Nausicaa. I guess I was wrong. Yeah. So, I mean, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, Charlize Theron as Athena would have been really good, in the same way that I think it was Robin Wright played... Was it Robin Wright who played Hippolyta in the Wonder Woman movie? She played somebody in the Wonder Woman movie, one of the Amazons.
She's one of the generals.
Yeah, she's one of the generals. Yeah. I think it was Julie Christie or somebody played, or Gwendolyn Christie played, I can't remember who played Apollos. It's been a while since I watched the Wonder Woman movie. But yeah, it's just kind of that kind of stature of Athena. Although, like I said, Isabella Rossellini played her really, really well in the movie. So
Connie Nielsen.
Okay. Yes. Matt Damon's got a hard job in front of him in my mind, because like Armand DeSante to me like looked how I pictured Odysseus, in a sense, because I think he's like Italian, and you know, so the kind of a Mediterranean actor, and I'm like, yeah, this is, you know, as opposed to Matt Damon. So we'll see. Anyway, let's get on to the plot.
And just last thing. Actually, there are two things I want to
say
to
you. Okay.
But the last thing on the movie, because we do have to talk about it, is Christopher Nolan deciding to go with everyday speech.
Mm-hmm.
And he has even recently said, like, this is either going to be great or it'll be terrible. I think everyone's already commented on Telemachus saying, my dad, and then Robert Pattinson being like, your daddy. And I'm like, oh gosh, how is this going to be? Way back when you were talking about, you quoted Emily Wilson in that lovely passage. I just feel like whenever this came out, I think you said when it was
2017.
It hits differently now. I mean, obviously that was in Trump's first presidency, but now with sort of this immigration and people really not following what they should be in terms of welcoming the stranger, I think that hits very differently. I think the themes of this also hit very differently in what that looks like. And I know that people also in reading that will be like, a murderer, you're going to welcome that. So like, obviously you have to look at the whole thing rather than take everything like super literally, but
yeah,
just thinking about, you know, every day you probably are passing at least one unhoused person, and considering, and I know there's a lot to talk about, but just saying that, I think in these current times that this work as a whole, I think is something that we can, it hits us differently, which we've constantly had this conversation about when we read things, our time in our lives and the context in which we're reading, that is going to have an effect on how we interpret certain works, and I think that's true here.
Okay, yeah, no, I agree, and I was thinking of that as I read that passage a moment ago, as well as when I, like, you know, was flipping back and prepping for this episode, and we could get into a little bit more, but there is that idea that a lot of these works endure because we can look at them and look at today and see how, you know, how we're reflected and how, what the points are making and things like that. Literature does not happen in a vacuum, which is like I used to say to my students, and they're like, what? I'm like, a couple notes before I get into the plot synopsis. First of all, I wrote this all myself, and about, I think about halfway through, Stella messaged me to say, you know, there's summaries of each book in the back of the book. And I finally went back and looked at them like, damn. But I was like, well, I was like, you know what? I'm in for a penny, in for a pound. So I did. What I would do is I read the book. I would write down like a quick summary on a post-it notes, like as going through it and just kind of like giving that. And then I would go and type it up. So it took me a while to put it together. The other thing is that I pre-recorded the summary for the sake of our time here. And I butcher Greek names, as I really don't intend to butcher foreign names on this podcast, but it always seems to happen. And I butcher a number of them. And then I realized as I was flipping through the book the other day that there's a glossary in the back of the book with pronunciations. So yeah, it's on me for not doing my due diligence. By the way, listeners, its runtime is 41 minutes and 13 seconds.
Did you edit it?
I edited it and everything.
Oh my
yes.
Gosh,
so
Tom.
If you're like, I don't want to hear Tom.
That's wild.
Read this summary of the Odyssey, this synopsis. Skip ahead 41 minutes and 13 seconds or thereabouts. And you'll get to our discussion. I'm just kind of giving you all an out. So you're like, good God, because this episode is going to be longer than usual. Without further ado, here's the summary of the Odyssey. Stella and I will see you on the other side of 41 minutes and 13 seconds. Book 1, The Boy and the Goddess. We begin with the invocation of the Muse. Tell me about a complicated man. Muse, tell me how he wandered and was lost when he had wrecked the holy town of Troy, and where he went and who he met, the pain he suffered in the storms at sea, and how he worked to save his life and bring his men back home. He failed to keep them safe. Poor fools, they ate the sun god's cattle, and the god kept them from home. Now, goddess, child of Zeus, tell the old story for our modern times. Find the beginning. Homer lets us know that Odysseus left Ithaca to fight in the Trojan War and still has not returned. Instead, he's been trapped on Calypso's island of Ogygia since being cursed by Poseidon to wander and not get home after he blinded Poseidon's son Polyphemus. On Olympus, Zeus broods over the death of Agamemnon, who was killed by his wife Clytemnestra after she conspired with her lover Aegisthus. Aegisthus was then killed by Agamemnon's son Orestes. In the midst of Zeus's brooding, Athena approaches with pleas for Odysseus to return home. Zeus says that he'll send Hermes to Ogygia to tell Calypso to let him go home. Athena also says that she will go to Ithaca to guide Odysseus's son Telemachus. In Ithaca, where Odysseus is still the king, but absent, 100 suitors have been loitering and squatting in Odysseus's palace, waiting for his wife Penelope to decide which one of them she will marry. After all, the Trojan War ended 10 years ago, and everybody assumes that Odysseus is now dead. It's only fair that she gets over this and remarries. But Penelope does not want to remarry, and she's been stalling them for years. Athena disguises herself as an old family friend named Mentor. Telemachus greets her and offers her hospitality. She begins to advise him, telling him that he needs to go search for his father, and this means he has to leave Ithaca for Pylos to see Nestor and then to Sparta to see Menelaus. Telemachus then addresses the suitors. He tells them that they should go home, and if they should continue to abuse the palace, he will pray to Zeus for vengeance. This has no effect. Antinous, who is the alpha suitor, talks back to him to tell him that he's weak. He's backed up by Eurymachus, and soon the others brush off these threats. Telemachus returns to his room where the loyal family nurse Eurycleia tends to him before he goes to bed. Book 2, A Dangerous Journey. Telemachus calls the Greek council to plead his case. The council has not met since Odysseus went to war nearly 20 years ago, listens to his pleas for justice against the suitors. Then, Antinous butts in and calls Telemachus a stuck-up, willful little boy, and reveals that Penelope did agree to take one of them as a husband, but would not decide until she finished weaving a funeral shroud for Odysseus's aging father, Laertes. However, every night for 3 years, Penelope has been sneaking out to the loom and undoing that day's weaving. The suitors found this out because one of the maids that they had taken as a lover sold her out. Antinous then doubles down and says they are not leaving the palace until Penelope chooses one of them. Telemachus then says he cannot force his mother to do anything and repeats his promise to call upon the gods if they continue to squat the palace. After he says this, Zeus sends two eagles down and they attack the suitors. The prophet Halitherses sees this as a warning, but Eurymachus tells him to bugger off. Odysseus, he says, is dead and the suitors will get what they want. Telemachus appears to relent but wants one thing, a ship and a crew so that he can sail to Pylos and Sparta to confirm that his father is indeed dead. If he does, he will give Penelope to a new husband. Mentor speaks up and shames those who have been present and then offers to go volunteer and get people for the crew. Then Telemachus stands up to Antinous, who laughs about him behind his back. Telemachus goes to Eurycleia and tells her what his real plans are, and then he swears her to secrecy. In the middle of the night, Athena disguises herself as Telemachus and puts a sleeping spell on the suitors, allowing the son of Odysseus to sneak out in his ships. He's off to Pylos, and the suitors will be waiting to kill him when he returns. Book 3, An Old King Remembers. Telemachus arrives in Pylos, accompanied by Athena, who is still disguised as Mentor. He sees people making a sacrifice to Poseidon. Athena then tells him to seek out King Nestor. Telemachus is nervous that he won't say the right thing to Nestor, but Athena reassures him that he knows what he's doing. They head to the center of town and are immediately offered hospitality at a feast. Nestor's son Pisistratus offers a prayer to Athena, and Athena prays to Poseidon. Once everyone has eaten, Nestor asks the guests to introduce themselves. Telemachus does so and asks Nestor what he knows about Odysseus. Nestor recalls the war, listing a number of men who had died. He talks about how Odysseus was a clever man. He also talks about how the journey back home was arduous as they contended for with the anger of the gods. He knows who got home safely, and he also recalls the death of Agamemnon. Nestor then talks about what he knows about Penelope's suitors, and Telemachus is doubtful that even the gods can't make this right. Mentor says that they do what they can to protect those they love, but fate is ultimately stronger. Telemachus asks for the stories of Agamemnon and Menelaus. Nestor goes into detail about how Odysseus seduced Clytemnestra while Agamemnon was fighting at Troy, and how Agamemnon was killed, and how Orestes got his revenge. Menelaus did return safely from Troy and settled down. Nestor tells Telemachus to go to Sparta and insists that they travel over land and offers them transport. Athena flies away, and Nestor tells Telemachus that he is going to be a hero because he is blessed by the gods. Nestor orders his best horses to be used to pull an ornate carriage that they will build for Telemachus. He presents it to Odysseus' son, and Telemachus heads to Sparta. Book 4, What the Sea God Said. Telemachus arrives in Sparta. He heads to Menelaus's palace, where they are celebrating the marriage of Menelaus's daughter Hermione to Achilles' son Neoptolemus, as well as the marriage of his son Megapenthes to Iphilike, who is the daughter of Elector. Menelaus lets the visitors in, and Helen tells him that the leader of this pack looks like Odysseus, so he must be Telemachus. She notes that Odysseus left Telemachus behind as a baby when the war started, saying, "They made my face the cause that hounded them." Menelaus agrees with her, and Pisistratus tells him that, yes, this is Telemachus. Menelaus then talks about Odysseus and how important his friendship was. Everyone cries, many of them remembering who they lost in the war. Helen eventually has the last word of the night. After she mixes a sleeping potion into the wine, she tells a story. It's about how Odysseus snuck into Troy disguised as a poor beggar. Helen saw through it and watched him, but promised to not betray him. He told her about their plans, which made her hopeful because she wanted to go home. Menelaus talks about how Odysseus was brave inside the Trojan horse as well as clever. And the next morning, Telemachus asks him if he had any news of his father, and he tells him about the situation back in Ithaca. Menelaus curses the suitors and tells him of his own struggles getting home. He was blown off course to Egypt, where he suffered at the hands of Proteus. He recalls the fate of a number of other Achaeans. Ajax and Agamemnon especially. Proteus told Menelaus that Odysseus is on Calypso's island shedding floods of tears. His crew is dead and he has no boat. She has him trapped. After he finishes the story, Menelaus offers Telemachus a place to stay as well as gifts. Back in Ithaca, the suitors plot to kill Telemachus by setting a trap. They hide a ship near the entrance to the main port. A houseboy goes to Penelope and tells her about what the suitors are planning to do. She talks about how much she loves Odysseus, then is sad that Telemachus has left. The houseboy tells her that Telemachus went to Pylos, and Eurycleia comforts her. Athena sends a phantom, who looks like Penelope's sister, Iphitemi, into Penelope's dream. She tells her that Telemachus will be home and has not angered the gods. But Penelope still worries. She's already lost her mother, and her son has enemies. The phantom tells her to have courage and that Athena guides him. Penelope asks for word of Odysseus, but the phantom says she can't tell her if he's alive or dead. Book 5, From the Goddess to the Storm. We are now finally with Odysseus, who has been trapped on Aegygia for the last 7 years. Athena pleads her cause to Zeus, and Zeus reminds her of how she is protecting both Odysseus and Telemachus. He then sends Hermes to Aegygia to tell Calypso to let Odysseus go. He also decrees that Odysseus will drift for 20 days on a makeshift raft and will land in Scheria, where the Phaeacians will take him in and give him transport home. Calypso does not like this. She rails at Hermes, calling the gods cruel and jealous, and calling them out on how the female gods are always punished for involvement with mortals while the men are not. She says that she will do what Zeus asks first, but tempts Odysseus one last time. He tells her that while she's obviously far more beautiful than Penelope, it is Penelope whom he loves. So Calypso has sex with him one more time and then gives Odysseus what he needs to build a raft, and he takes off for home. Poseidon at this point has been attending a wedding in Ethiopia, and he gets back and he realizes what's going on and sends waves to attack Odysseus and wrecks the raft. Seeing this, Ino, who has sympathy for Odysseus, tells him to discard his clothes and swim for Phaeacia. She gives him her veil and tells him to trust the waves. Despite Poseidon's efforts to thwart him, Odysseus reaches Scheria and the kingdom of Phaeacia. He goes into the woods and Athena puts a spell on him so he can sleep. Book 6, A Princess and Her Laundry. While Odysseus sleeps, Athena goes to the Phaeacians. Homer tells us how the Phaeacians used to live on Hyperia, but the Cyclopes kept looting them, and Nauthesis, their king, took them to Scheria. Alcinous is the current king. His daughter is named Nausicaa. Athena disguises herself as Nausicaa's friend and tells her that she is not doing her duty as a woman should. She needs to go down to the shore and do the laundry. Nausicaa then wakes up and really, really wants to go do the laundry, so she and her servants go and will do the laundry. And after they finish the laundry, they play ball, and their fun wakes up Odysseus. He doesn't know if the voices are human or if they're nymphs, so he covers himself up and he jumps out from the bushes. This freaks the girls out, but Nausicaa is unfazed. She explains who she is and then tells her girls to help him. They clean him up, and Athena gives him a glow-up. Nausicaa realizes he's someone important, and to please the gods, they feed him. She tells him he has to go into town. She can only take him so far because if the people see her with him, they might gossip that she's with a stranger. So she drops him off and heads to the palace. Odysseus prays to Athena. Out of respect for Poseidon, Athena does not answer his prayer, but Homer tells us that she will only do this until he finally reaches home. Book 7, A Magical Kingdom. Odysseus walks into town, helped along by a mist that Athena provides to shield him from suspicious townfolk. Athena then appears as a young girl who tells him to go into the palace and greet Queen Arete first. She also gives him some background on the king and queen, saying that Alcinous and Arete are both descendants of Poseidon. Odysseus enters and throws himself at Arete's feet. She tells her husband to treat this stranger as a guest. At first, they wonder if he is a god or some other creature in disguise. He tells them that he is human, and without revealing his true identity, tells them how he got there. His crew is dead, he was trapped on Aegygia, and journeyed here where Nausicaa found him. Alcinous wonders why Nausicaa didn't just bring the stranger to him, and Odysseus says that he was embarrassed and nervous, and people do get suspicious. Alcinous praises Odysseus, saying he's the right type of man for his daughter. But then he says that he will give Odysseus what he wants, a safe journey home on a fast ship. So they feast, and then they sleep. Book 8, The Songs of a Poet. The next morning, Alcinous addresses his people, saying they have a guest, and that means feasting, games, and stories. They launch and christen the ship that will bring Odysseus home. The blind poet Demodocus tells the story of Odysseus and Achilles and how they argued at a sacrificial feast. Odysseus tears up but manages not to give himself away. Next comes games, which Odysseus doesn't initially take part in and then does after being goaded along by Alcinous' son. He shows himself to be skilled and strong, hurling a discus further than anybody. Demodocus sings again, this time about Ares and his affair with Aphrodite and how they were caught by her husband Hephaestus. Ares was spared punishment by Poseidon. After that story, they eat some more, and after there's dancing, Odysseus makes his own request for a story. He wants to hear the story of the wooden horse. Demodocus tells it, and as Odysseus listens, he cries, because you see, Odysseus was one of the architects of the Trojan horse plot and led them on their mission. Alcinous notices Odysseus's tears, and after the song is done, asks for his name and where he's from. He notes that Poseidon has never liked the aid they give to travelers, and he's prophesied to sink one of their ships and cut the island off from the outside world. Then he tells Odysseus to say who he is at Troy, and our hero readies to reveal himself. Book 9, A Pirate in a Shepherd's Cave. After thanking Alcinous for his hospitality, Odysseus reveals his true identity and begins telling the tale of the 3 years between leaving Troy and washing up on Ægygia. Thus begins the 4 books of flashback told from Odysseus's point of view that are often referred to as the Wanderings of Odysseus. After leaving Troy, Zeus blows them off course to Ismarus, home of the Ciconies. They raid the town, kill the men, take the women, but linger too long and are attacked by allies and neighbors of the Ciconies, and they narrowly escape with several of the crew dying. Zeus hurls another wind at them, and when Odysseus tries to correct course for home, they're besieged by a storm for 9 days. Finally, they make landfall at the land of the Lotus Eaters. Odysseus sends 3 men to scout the area, while the rest of the crew tends to the ships. When they do not return, Odysseus sees that they have encountered the Lotus Eaters, and they've also eaten the lotus flower, which made them want to stay and eat more to forget home. Odysseus drags them back to the ships, and their next stop is the island of the Cyclopes. These are giant, one-eyed creatures who are the children of Poseidon. The crew explores the island and discovers Polyphemus's cave. Odysseus and 12 of his men go into the cave, while the rest guard their ships. Soon, Polyphemus returns with his sheep and goats. He milks them and eats his meal. When he sees Odysseus, our hero tells him that they are Greeks from Troy who have gotten lost. He asks for hospitality, as it is custom. Polyphemus does not care about customs. He said he will decide how things work, then asks Odysseus about his ship. Odysseus lies and says they are shipwrecked. Polyphemus responds by eating 2 of Odysseus's crew. During the night, while Polyphemus sleeps, Odysseus devises a plan. He knows he simply cannot kill the Cyclops because the only person who can move the boulder blocking the entrance is Polyphemus, and killing him means they'll be stuck in the cave. So he takes Polyphemus's walking stick and hones it into a spear. When the Cyclops awakens, he offers him wine. Loving the wine, Polyphemus asks for more and then promises Odysseus a present if he tells him his name. Odysseus lies and says his name is No Man. The present? Well, Polyphemus will eat No Man first. Our Cyclops gets drunk and he passes out. The men heat up the spear in the fire and drive it into his eye, twisting and gouging it. Polyphemus cries out. When the other Cyclopes ask what's wrong, he yells, "My friends, No Man is killing me by tricks, not force." And their response? "If no one hurts you, you are all alone. Great Zeus has made you sick. No help for that. Pray to your father, mighty Lord Poseidon." Polyphemus sits by the entrance to the cave, trying to catch any man who flees. Seeing this, Odysseus ties the men to the underside of the rams, so when they leave the cave, the men will leave the cave undetected. Odysseus' ram is the last, and it looks like Polyphemus might discover him, but he does not. Close call. The crew rushes to the ships and sails away, taking the sheep with them. As they head out to sea, Odysseus taunts the Cyclops. Polyphemus starts hurling boulders, which draw them back to land. Odysseus yells at his crew to roll harder. The crew begs him to stop taunting the Cyclops. Then Odysseus says that he, Odysseus, is the one that destroyed his eyesight. Polyphemus groans, realizing a prophecy has come true. He prays to Poseidon, asking for Odysseus to never reach home. But if it is fated so that he sees his family, then let him get there late and with no honor. in pain and lacking ships, and having caused the death of all his men, and let him find more trouble in his own home. We, of course, know that all of this has come to pass. They reach safety and sacrifice to Zeus, but the god ignores them, and after a night of respite, they sail off again. Book 10, The Winds and the Witch. Odysseus and his crew reach the island of Aeolus, the god of the winds. They stay for a month, and Odysseus tells Aeolus and his children stories about the war and the Greeks' journey home. He asks for help, and Aeolus gives them a bag of three of the four winds so they will have smooth sailing home. They almost make it home. They, like, literally spot the shoreline of Ithaca. But Odysseus falls asleep, and his crew gets jealous of how much attention and loot their captain has been receiving, and thinking that he's going to keep it from them, so they start digging through everything. They open the bag of winds, and the ship is blown completely back off course. When they return to Aeolus, he rejects them and sends them away. They eventually land in Lystragonia. It seems welcoming at first, and Odysseus sends three men as scouts. They meet the daughter of King Antiphates, who sends them to her father, but the danger is then revealed. The Lystragonians are giants who eat people. One of Odysseus's men gets taken. He gets his crew on board and sets sail. His ship makes it away from the island, but the other ships do not. So he's down to one ship. And this remaining ship soon reaches Aea. It is the home of the witch Circe. Odysseus sends 22 men out to explore, even though the men are tired of watching their friends die at every turn. When they reach Circe's palace, she takes them in and feeds them. But the wine they drink is really a potion, and it turns them into pigs. Odysseus heads to the palace. Hermes intercepts him and gives him moly, an herb that will ward off Circe's spell. Think something like wearing garlic when you're near a vampire. Then he tells him to attack her and also sleep with her, but not before making her take an oath to not harm him. He follows these directions, and she recognizes him, saying that the gods said this would come to pass. Then she turns his men back into humans. She sends Odysseus back to his ship and tells his men to come with him, and that all is safe. All of them agree except for Eurycles, who has witnessed what Circe did. They stay there a year. Eventually, they need to move on. Odysseus begs Circe to fulfill the vows she made and let them go home. She says she will, but Odysseus now has a side quest. Go into the underworld and seek out the dead Theban prophet Tiresias. He will give Odysseus much-needed advice. She also tells him what ceremonies he has to perform and what sacrifices need to be made, providing a ram and a ewe that he'll need to gain access. And then she disappears. Book 11, The Dead. Following Circe's directions, Odysseus and his men sail to the land of the dead. Sacrifices are made, and Odysseus begins to see the spirits of the people he knew. The first is Elpenor. He's one of Odysseus's crew, was recently killed in a drunken fall on Aea. They talk, and then Odysseus counters his mother, Anticlea, but he decides he will talk to her after he completes his quest. He finds Tiresias, and the prophet tells Odysseus that Poseidon remains mad because of the blinding Polyphemus. He says that Odysseus is supposed to suffer but can reach home. Tiresias tells him to sail toward Thrinacia, the island of the sun god Helios. He warns him, however, to not eat the cattle, because that will doom them. If Odysseus escapes, he will then come home late and be exhausted, alone, and he will find invaders at home. He tells Odysseus that he will kill the suitors. Then he will have to take an oar to the people with no knowledge of the sea. When someone refers to the oar as a winnowing fan, he then has to make a sacrifice to Poseidon. Tiresias leaves. Anticlea approaches and they talk. She tells Odysseus that Penelope is okay and she is waiting for him. Telemachus tends to the estate, and Laertes is living in self-imposed exile. She tells him that her grief over missing him led to her death. She tries to embrace him, but she's a spirit and he cannot. Persephone sends the daughters and wives of the warriors to tell their stories. This is often called the catalogue of heroines. They are Tyro, Antiope, Alcmene, Megara, Epicaste, Chloris, Leda, Iphimedia, Phaedra, Procris, Ariadne, Myra, Clymene, and Eurypyle. At this point, back in Phaeacia, Odysseus pauses. He begins to feel tired. Arete says they are going to give him VIP treatment and a quick ride home, and King Alcinous agrees, and then asks if Odysseus saw any of the men from the war. Despite being tired, Odysseus continues his story. The first person he meets is Agamemnon, who tells him about his death, including a bit about the death of Cassandra, and then warns Odysseus not to trust his wife. He then speaks to Achilles. Odysseus tells him about his son Neoptolemus and his heroism in the fall of Troy. Odysseus also sees Patroclus, Antilochus, Ajax, along with the mythical characters Minos, Orion, Tityos, Tantalus, Sisyphus, and Heracles. After Heracles laments his fate and disappears, more dead approach. Odysseus decides this is the best time to leave the underworld and heads back to his ship, and once on board, they sail back to Aea. Book 12, Difficult Choices. Odysseus and his men return to Circe. They hold a funeral for Elpenor. Then Circe tells him where to go and warns him about the four hazards that are along his way, the Sirens, Scylla, Charybdis, and the cattle of Helios. The crew sets sail again. As they approach the island where the Sirens live, Odysseus presses wax into the ears of all of his men except himself. He wants to hear the Sirens' song and has the crew tie him to the mast. He listens to the song, screaming at the crew to turn toward the island, but the crew cannot hear them, and they sail to safety. Now they come upon the strait that contains Scylla and Charybdis. Scylla is a six-headed sea monster, and Charybdis is a monstrous whirlpool. Following Circe's advice, Odysseus guides his crew towards Scylla. They lose six men, one for each of Scylla's heads, instead of having everybody die in the whirlpool. Sailing away from Scylla and Charybdis, Odysseus spots Thrinacia. He tells his men to avoid it, but Zeus has other plans and creates a massive storm that keeps them there for a while. Supplies run low. Odysseus once again warns the crew to not eat the cattle, but they do it anyway while Odysseus is sleeping. Helios' daughter, Lampetia, runs to Zeus to seek revenge on those who ate the cattle. Zeus sends a thunderbolt that destroys Odysseus' ship and kills everybody on board except for Odysseus. Odysseus hangs onto the wreck and is swept back to Scylla and Charybdis. He waits until Charybdis spits up planks of the mast and then uses a large plank as a raft. Zeus makes sure Scylla does not spot him. He then drifts for 9 days and reaches Aegygia. It's here where he finishes his story. Book 13, Two Tricksters. After Odysseus finishes his story, Alcinous says he will provide a fast ship and a way home. The next morning, the ship leaves Phaeacia and takes Odysseus to Ithaca, dropping him off on a beach while he is asleep and leaving behind riches and treasures. Seeing that Odysseus has reached home, Poseidon begs Zeus to let him punish somebody. Zeus says he will allow Poseidon to get revenge against the Phaeacians and suggests that he turn the ship to stone just as it reaches home port. Then Poseidon can surround the island with mountains and seal it off from the world. When the Phaeacians see the ship turned to stone, they panic because this is part of a prophecy. So they start making all sorts of sacrifices to Poseidon. Odysseus wakes up and does not know where he is. Athena appears to him and tells him that he's in Ithaca. Not totally convinced, Odysseus lies about being from Crete, but then Athena reveals herself and Odysseus is overjoyed. She tells him that Penelope has been faithful and Callimachus has gone off in search of him. She disguises him as an old beggar and tells him to find the swineherd Eumaeus. Then she heads to Sparta. Book 14, A Loyal Slave. Odysseus walks to Eumaeus' home. Eumaeus lets him in and gives him food and a place to stay. They talk. Eumaeus says that he is not sure Odysseus will return, is clearly upset. He also talks about Telemachus' travels to Pylos and Sparta. Odysseus, when asked to tell his story, tells an altered version, where he says he's from Crete and has endured all sorts of tribulations. Knowing now that Eumaeus can be trusted, Odysseus tells him some war stories about himself, but he does not reveal that he's Odysseus. Book 15, The Prince Returns. In Sparta, Athena tells Telemachus that he needs to return home, but not to sail directly into the harbor. She tells him to moor the ship on a remote location and head to the house of the swineherd Eumaeus. Before leaving Sparta, Telemachus receives a gift of a robe from Helen and a treasure from Menelaus. He heads back to Pylos, gets into his ship, and sails home. When he reaches the island, there is a good omen of a hawk carrying a dove in its talons flying by them. Following Athena's advice, Telemachus lands away from where the suitors lie in wait to ambush him. He goes to Eumaeus, who's been talking to Odysseus. They are sharing stories, and Eumaeus tells Odysseus of his life. the son of a king, he was stolen from his house by Phoenician pirates with the help of a maid that his father employed. The pirates took him all over the seas until Laertes, Odysseus' father, bought him. Laertes' wife brought him up alongside her own daughter, the youngest born. Book 16, Father and Son. Telemachus arrives at Eumaeus' house and sees the beggar who is Odysseus in disguise. Eumaeus tells him to bring the beggar to the palace. Telemachus doubts the visitor's intentions. Odysseus spins a story for his son, basically to gauge if Telemachus can be trusted. Telemachus says he misses his father and he talks about his family's trials. One thing he notes is that Laertes is not eating and starting to waste away. Eumaeus leaves to tell Penelope what he's learned about Odysseus. Once he's done, Athena removes Odysseus' disguise and reveals his true identity. Telemachus doesn't believe it at first, but Odysseus affirms he's genuine. He tells Telemachus his real story. Then he devises a plan. Telemachus will return to the palace. Later, Eumaeus and Odysseus will go there, and even if Odysseus gets abused in his beggar disguise, Telemachus is not allowed to get angry because Odysseus doesn't want to blow his cover. Then they'll get their revenge. Eumaeus arrives in the palace. He tells Penelope what Telemachus told him to say. The suitors realize that Telemachus is alive, so they rework their plans. They still intend to squat at the palace and kill the prince. Penelope tells the suitors they need to stop and admonishes them, but Antinous lies and tells her, oh, we don't have any intention to harm Telemachus. No. Penelope then goes back to her room and weeps for Odysseus. Athena helps her go to sleep. Then Eumaeus returns to his house and tells them that he saw the suitors in the harbor, which means Telemachus successfully avoided that trap. They eat and they sleep. Book 17, Insults and Abuse. Telemachus returns to the palace. He's greeted with love by Penelope, Eurycleia, and others. Penelope asks about Odysseus, but he deflects, telling her to go take her bath, and that he was invited a new friend to join them later. He heads to the hall and sits with his friends. Later, Penelope comes back down and he tells her about his trip and that he's been told Odysseus is on Aegygia with Calypso. The prophet Theoclymenus then says that there's more to it. Odysseus is in Ithaca, and he's on his way, and he is plotting to destroy the suitors. The suitors ignore this and just continue their reverie. Odysseus, who is again disguised as the beggar, and Eumaeus reach the palace. On their way, he's mocked by Melanthius, who wonders why Eumaeus is bringing a ragged beggar into the palace. They then come across Argos. He's Odysseus's dog, who has been discarded to a dung heap. Argos has been waiting patiently for his master's return for 20 years. He smells the beggar and he knows it's Odysseus. Odysseus asks Eumaeus about the dog, and Eumaeus talks about how great and loyal the dog was. Odysseus and Eumaeus move on, and Argos, having finally seen his master's return, passes away. After Odysseus enters the palace and joins the suitors, he's taunted by the suitors and Antinous questions why he's there. Telemachus defends the beggar, and Odysseus defends himself, but he's hit. Penelope witnesses this and is disgusted, and she asks Eumaeus to bring the beggar to her. Eumaeus goes to Odysseus, and Odysseus says that he will speak to her later when they can talk alone because he has information about her husband, but it's best told one-on-one. Penelope agrees, and the two new guests join the feast. Book 18, Two Beggars. Another beggar shows up. He and his Odysseus fight. The suitors are surprised at how strong Odysseus is for an old man. Athena gives Penelope an idea. She will go to see the suitors and also tell Telemachus to distance himself from them because they want him dead. She then prays and Athena gives her a glow up. She heads down to the courtyard and admonishes Telemachus for allowing a beggar to be insulted. Telemachus says he doesn't blame her for being upset and he says how he wishes the suitors were dead. When she addresses the suitors, she said it has been too long and her time to choose a new husband is at hand. The suitors bring her gifts but refuse her plea to go home until she announces her decision. They will not leave until this is all over. Meanwhile, Melantho, a slave girl who's sleeping with Eurymachus, teases Odysseus. Odysseus responds with threats. Athena allows the suitors to continue to taunt him so this pain sinks down deep. This particular episode ends with someone throwing a stool at Odysseus' head. Telemachus stops everything and tells them all to go home. Amphinomus agrees and gets the other suitors to go as well, so everybody actually does leave for the night. Book 19, The Queen and the Beggar. Alone with Telemachus, Odysseus tells him to hide the weapons. Telemachus goes and does so, and gets Eurycleia to put the women in their rooms. Melantho scolds Odysseus again, and Penelope hears this and dresses her down. Penelope sits with the beggar. First, she asks him who his parents are and where he comes from. He says thinking of his family is painful and brings up grief. She then tells him about how much she misses her husband and how terrible the situation is. He then lies and says he is from Crete and his name is Athor. He saw Odysseus early in the war and that they hosted him. She weeps and asks for proof. What was he wearing? He describes Odysseus as a king setting off to war, which brings up memories and more grief for Penelope. She tells him that she now considers him a friend. He then says that he heard Odysseus is alive and he's close to home. He then talks about how he heard about Odysseus's crew being killed by Zeus for eating Helios's cattle, and that Odysseus was in Phaeacia but is now on the way. Penelope offers him a bed, but he refuses it. She then sends Eurycleia to wash his feet. While Eurycleia is doing this, she tells a story of how Odysseus got his name and how he got a scar on his leg from a wild boar hunt. She then touches the scar, and she realizes that the beggar is in fact Odysseus. He gets her to stay quiet, and he tells her that he has a plan. Penelope returns, and she and the beggar talk about prophecy, and she explains her plan to choose a new husband, which is through a contest. He tells her not to delay the contest, and Penelope wishes he could stay with her all night, but knows she has to return to her room. She does so, and as she cries over Odysseus, Athena gets her to sleep. Book 20, The Last Banquet. Odysseus lies awake, thinking over his plan and reminding himself of what he has already endured, especially in Polyphemus's cave. Athena comes to him and insists that he go to sleep, and then she puts a sleep spell on him. Penelope wakes up before dawn and prays for death if she winds up with another husband, while Odysseus wakes up and prays to Zeus. Eumaeus and Odysseus confer. Melanthus appears again to taunt Odysseus. Another herdsman named Philodius comes and greets the beggar with warmth. He expresses loyalty to Odysseus, and Odysseus promises that he will be rewarded for that. Meanwhile, the suitors plot to kill Telemachus. As they do, Zeus again sends the sign of an eagle holding a dove in its mouth. Amphinous says that's a bad sign, and they will fail to kill Telemachus. So they agree, and instead go ahead and do what they've done best, eat, drink, and insult the beggar. Telemachus stands up for his father, even trying to appeal to the better judgment, but Athena will not allow them to listen, and instead makes their behavior worse. The prophet Theoclymenus tells the suitors of a vision he saw that has them all screaming and dying at night, and they laugh at him. He says he's leaving, and they're going to die. They ignore him, they go back to feasting, and Homer ends book 20 with, "But no dinner time could be less welcome than the one the mighty man and goddess would soon bring them, in revenge, because they started it and wronged him first." Book 21, An Archery Contest. The contest is held. Penelope has told the suitors that what they must do is try to string Odysseus's bow and shoot an arrow through the row of 12 rings of axe handles and hit a target on the other side. It is, in fact, an impossible task. The bow is special. Iphitus gave the bow to Odysseus just before he was killed by Heracles. And Odysseus is the only one who can string it, much like only Arthur can wield Excalibur and Thor can only wield Mjolnir. Telemachus attempts the bow, playing up how hard the task is. Then each suitor tries. While they do so, Odysseus reveals himself to Eumaeus and Philodius. He tells them if they win, he will reward them richly. He tells Eumaeus to give him his bow after all the suitors' attempts, and after the suitors refuse to let him try that, which he's sure he's going to do, and then he should make sure the women are safe. Philodius is supposed to lock everyone in the courtyard. The suitors finish trying. Odysseus approaches the bow, but is ridiculed and refused. Penelope says to let him try. Telemachus tells Penelope to leave and lock the doors behind her. She does. Then Eumaeus gives Odysseus the bow. The ridicule from the suitors continues. With everything in place, Odysseus strings the bow and fires true. Book 22, Bloodshed. Odysseus strips naked and shoots Antinous through the throat. The suitors try to arm themselves but can't find their weapons, and then they rebuke the still disguised Odysseus. When Odysseus tells them he will have his revenge, the suitors realize who he really is, and they start to bargain for their lives. He kills Eurymachus, and the bloodbath begins. Odysseus and Telemachus kill every last suitor, and after the slaughter is over, Telemachus brings in Eurycleia. Odysseus instructs her to find the maids who betrayed Penelope. He then makes those maids clean up the bodies and the blood in the hall. Once they finish, he hangs them all in public. Odysseus orders Hall to be cleansed of evil. Then the women of the palace come out, greeting him in tears because he's finally home. Book 23, The Olive Tree Bed. Eurycleia goes to Penelope and tells her that Odysseus has returned. Penelope does not believe her, even after Eurycleia tells her about how Odysseus and Telemachus killed all of the suitors. They head to the hall. Telemachus gets annoyed that Penelope is not embracing her husband. She tells him that she has to test him to make sure he's the real thing. She decides to do this by mentioning something only the two of them will know. Odysseus tells Telemachus to let her. Odysseus and Telemachus begin doing damage control to not let the word of the suitor's death spread too quickly. He tells his people to get a party going so the people will think that Penelope has chosen a suitor. Eurynome bathes Odysseus and Athena gives him a glow-up. When Penelope sees him, she tells Eurycleia to make the bed for the king and put his bed outside the bedroom. Odysseus says, like, that's impossible. I built the bed into an olive tree and I built the room around it. This is the sign that Penelope has been looking for. She takes Odysseus to bed, they have sex, and then afterwards they stay up most of the night talking. He tells her everything that has happened to him. They sleep. When they wake up, Odysseus says that the suitors' families are going to come for him and she should stay out of sight while he finishes everything. Book 24, Restless Spirits. The spirits of the suitors journey to the underworld. They see Achilles, Patroclus, Ajax, and Agamemnon. Agamemnon and Achilles discuss their deaths as well as the concept of honor, especially in death. They notice the suitors and Epaminondas tells them about what the suitors did. Agamemnon is glad that Penelope stayed faithful, unlike Clytemnestra. In Ithaca, Odysseus, Telemachus, and the herdsmen head to the farm where Laertes has been in exile. He's tending the crops. Odysseus pretends to be a visitor to Ithaca. Laertes tells him how the cruel suitors have taken over. Odysseus keeps up the rules until he sees Laertes so upset so that Odysseus has to reveal himself. When Laertes asks for proof of Odysseus, Odysseus shows him the scar on his thigh and points out all the trees that Laertes planted and Odysseus named when he was a child. Father and son embrace. Odysseus invites him to dinner. A slave bathes Laertes and Athena gives him, yes, a glow up. They sit and eat. Word of the suitor's death spreads and the families take to arms. On Olympus, Athena begs Zeus to not make any more war. Zeus says that she can fix it and make them all swear allegiance to Odysseus. The families march on the palace. Odysseus, Telemachus, and Laertes arm themselves. Athena tells Laertes that he is a favorite of hers and tells him to throw his spear, and he hits Euphaetes, father of Antinous, who is the one that instigated the whole battle. After Phaetes dies, a battle begins, but Athena steps in to end it. She tells the Ithacans to stop fighting. The families drop their weapons. Odysseus charges, but Zeus sends a thunderbolt down to stop him. Athena tells him to stop the war or suffer the wrath of Zeus. A relieved Odysseus complies. Athena makes everyone take an oath of peace, and as time goes on, she lives among them at times in the guise of mentor.
Okay, that was a lot. So we're gonna have our usual discussion. Before I get into it, I always ask the question, did you like it? I'm going to start with just the Odyssey itself, putting aside Wilson's translation aspect of it. Do you like the Odyssey?
Yes, I'll say yes, I do. I had to think about it because it's hard to, you know, pull Odysseus from the Odyssey. And he gets on my nerves a lot.
Yeah.
But I think overall, I do like the Odyssey.
I do too. You know, I mean, maybe it's because I've read it in at least in pieces so many times. And I'm so familiar with the story. It is one of my favorite epics. I've loved Built Beowulf. That was one of my favorite epics for a while. This is right up there with it. I really love this story. And I'll get into various reasons for it. But a lot of it involves the action and things, but also like the way the story is told and its structure and things that I think Homer, like, at least in my mind, kind of introduced to Western literature. But, you know, like I said, I'm not in academia. I teach high school English. So I'm just going to kind of come at it from that perspective when I'm talking about all of this. But no, I really do love this this poem. So I guess my question to you then is, like, what do you think of Emily Wilson's translation?
Yes, I really like Emily Wilson's translation. So part of it is like, you have to take what I'm going to say with a grain of salt, because I think there is obviously bias, given the fact that she is a woman. As far as I know, that's how she identifies. And I very much appreciate a woman, you know, dominating in male fields, and being one of the first, I guess, to really like venture into this. And I loved her Iliad, obviously. So mm-hmm. that, you know, I'm all for her translating all of the great works. I think that it has this, I'm going to repeat some of the things I said about the Iliad, but I think it has this readability that, especially now we're in some sort of literacy crisis, I'm finding out on the social medias, that people think that, what is the term that they said? Ableism now is, if people are using big words.
Really?
Well, that's
what called having a vocabulary.
I know. That's what someone has cried out of, like, if you're using big words, that's ableism. So we're actually in a bit of a literacy crisis.
We definitely are, yes.
But in turn, because of that place, I think this is very accessible. Obviously, I mean, there were a couple words I had to look up. Mm-hmm. There was a tool that he used that I was unsure what that was, well, you know, but that's called engaging with the reading, because there's a difference between people who are just like passively reading and they're just kind of going through and maybe they understand and comprehend what's going on. And then there are others who are asking questions and sure they come up with something or they come upon something that they don't understand and they immediately look it up rather than passing over it. But I think that those moments for me, I mean, obviously I don't mean this to sound arrogant, but obviously I'm more like academically trained. Mm-hmm. So this might come more easily than others, but I think that most people could pick this up and read it. I appreciate, which a lot of it comes from, I do really recommend. It's a 50, actually, isn't the intro like nearly 100 pages? It's a long intro.
There's a very long intro. And yes. The translator's note ends on page 91.
Yeah. So, you know, some people just like to skip all that and get to the meat, but yeah. I do recommend it just because it gives context to what she's doing. And it also gives reasons for how she may have meant changes to be. And being a woman, obviously that lends itself to interpreting things in different ways, because I think, and this is going to be like me generalizing, so again, you know, take what I say with a grain of salt, but I think generally with men, when they're translating some of these great works that were by perceivably men, mm-hmm. and in a particular time, they're going to think that, well, you know, women are going to be presented in this sort of way because that was that idea. And I think Emily Wilson begins to like push against that. And of course, like, it's still a patriarchal society. Yeah. Women were still oppressed. But I think that they weren't just like thrown away. Like, everyone has a certain role to play. And I think there's a depth. We do need to talk about Penelope because she is kind of shoved aside. But if you're, you know, if there's a word that seems like you can just say, oh, it's bitch, but what actually, well, cause that, like, you know, cause I think the word was something of like, but what does this actually mean? Or, yeah. you know, someone going after something is really how she interpreted it, rather than like being a dog. So more like being dogged in the mm-hmm. pursuit of something. And so changing that, and then, yeah, I mean, if there are people like Melantho, mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, it's this woman, terrible fate. Yes, she definitely went against the household and what she should have. But I think Emily is able to maybe also critique what some of the things that are going on there, which might be like the modernist lens that's coming in there to like have you question what's going on. Also, I was really struck by this representation of Penelope's hands and what they looked like and previous translations and what they were like, thick or fat hands. And she took it more to mean like strong or rugged, because it is true that someone who is weaving, I mean, that is not a delicate, it seems like it's delicate, but it that's a pretty rugged task to do. So I think she gives more than just, I think a typical male translator is going to push off the women and then be more like give more depth to the men. And obviously the women do not have a lot of screen time, but what is given to them, I think she starts asking some more questions. And I do think that obviously, sign of the times, when Homer slash a multitude of people were writing, we do have to look at that. But I do think sometimes they might have more of a feminine lens than we sort of, you know, give them credit for, because we even saw in the Iliad that while the bulk of it might have been blamed, you know, on Helen, there were other people saying like, why it was not her, you know, her fault, and like having questions and things like that. So I think just having a woman dig in more deeply and start to question what are these words and how do they mean in context, I think lent that. Not to say that these are like Fitzgerald and Fagles were lazy translators, but I do think their masculine lens pushes them in a certain direction that Emily is able to start to question and critique.
You know, I agree with every point you made, because, and I think we need more of this in looking at classic literature, because it has, you know, academia as a whole has been so male dominated for so long. And when I look at the criticism that I read off, because that was off the Wikipedia page, and then some of the other things, like when I come across people talking about Wilson's translation of the Odyssey on or the Iliad on like the socials, and I don't even seek it out, it'll pop up every once in a while. There seems to be this weird disdain for it, mostly from men. And the idea that it was made accessible seems like a backhanded compliment, which I don't see it as backhanded. I actually think I think that this is cinematic in a huge way. And I think that her making it accessible through the use of iambic pentameter and stuff really lends itself well to the poem, because as we said a number of times with literature that's considered the classics, you have this pedestal that a lot of them are put on. And this could be anything from the Odyssey and the Iliad to Ulysses or Frankenstein, like any novel that's considered kind of in the canon. And they become inaccessible to a lot of people because they are perceived as hard to read, especially something where you're reading this is in poetry. And, you know, poetry, a lot of people are very intimidated by poetry, especially something this length, because the way we are taught to read poetry is very elementary. It's very like stop at the end of a line. A lot of the poetry we see very early on is Dr. Seuss and nursery rhymes and things like that. And it's really hard to break people of that habit when you're reading poetry, you know, the whole concept of enjambment when the line continues, etc. So her making it accessible to me is a benefit to this book, because when you look at it, it is an epic in scope using characters and situations that we currently see making hundreds of millions of dollars at a box office. You know, nothing of this is anything we're not used to seeing already. And so you have this great ancient tale. I think that the men, you know, these are things that are gatekept too. So it's like, you know, when I see this, I see the sexism of the people who are and the misogynists and the people who are critiquing it because a woman translated. I think that's really, you know, just offensive to me, but it's completely unfair to Wilson, who really did a great job with this. Yeah. And it's not like she doesn't have the academic, you know, bona fides to do it, know, like, it's not like I freaking translate, you know, like.
And everyone, has an interpretation. I mean, when you translate, that's the thing about you're losing something and you're potentially gaining something when you go from any language to another one, especially with the ancients. I mean, if I'm just talking about Latin, like I've got to add all these words for something that was super clear initially. And I think I talked about in the previous episode, this wonderful moment where we were going through this translation and there was the two word sentence that my interpretation was like, you are lucky. And a student said, could that be lucky? Because it could have been an imperative. And I was like, wow. I didn't interpret it that way, but tell me why you did it that way and how the meaning changes. And then we had a discussion about that. So there is like that, that's an amazing thing to happen. And we do have to be clear that words have so many different meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And then the context definitely matters. And then the person's perception of what's going on in the story and in the sentence also matters.
I guess that's a good segue into just like one of the questions I do have about the translation is that, she pointed out, was pointed out in the reviews, and she actually has a whole section on this in her intro. It's the use of the word slave as opposed to like maidens or housekeeper, which I mean, it's technically correct. They were slave. In fact, I think Eumaeus talks about how Laertes essentially bought him. You know, and he was, and I think it's like he was, and he was loyal, et cetera, et cetera. I got used to it. It didn't, you know, I was kind of like, it kind of side-eyed it at first because the word slave in American culture has a very significant definition and image associated with it. And I know that slavery existed long before the chattel slavery system of the Americas. I mean, I got used to it after a while and was able to kind of see the context of the idea of a slave, even though there still is kind of a harshness about that word that I, you know, that I see. And I see how that can be uncomfortable for people reading the book. What was your perception of the use of that word?
Yeah. So this could be, this would be a sound clip that someone would take to use against me. So we'll all remember that there was context afterwards, but the sound clip is going to be that it didn't bother me. The reason why is because I deal with this every day in Latin. Very, very particular term, servus, meaning a slave. Ancilla is a slave woman. I think it needs to be clear that these people, if you say maid or servant, those people are getting paid. Those people have way more freedom. So I think we need to be very clear that these people did not have rights to certain, they might have gotten like a small wage, but they did not have rights. They were sold or they were inherited or they were born into the family, depending on their, you know, the ownership, they might have been treated well. They might have, it seemed like in this household, they were treated well until the end when the majority of the female slaves were hanged. Whether you agree with that reason or not, I'm sure we'll get to it. So I think we need to be very clear about it. I will say, and I think this might be Emily being English, that we have started shifting more in the US in particular, as well as I'm hoping classicists too. I mean, in particular, my text series that I have, instead of saying slave, we say enslaved person, which I keep, like, I slip on that. And I even tell my students, like, catch me on it, call me out on that, just so we can do that, just because that puts the onus on the person who has done this, you know, to the person we're doing, rather than like, this is their entire being. So I think that would have almost been better, but I think, wow, people would have totally called this woke if they haven't already, which I think they have been. And I think she just doesn't have that context necessarily, but I think we needed to use this vocabulary. Let's be clear, because when you soften, like, it's not doing anyone any favors to like soften it and use that other language. Yeah. So it didn't bother me in the sense of like, I'm used to it and I'm like, yep, that's how it is. Yep. This is how they're treated. All of that stuff. Not to say that, like, you know, it didn't, that it's unfortunate, I guess, that I've become like, yeah, this is the way of things and everything, but I don't think people should be up in arms about it, because that's the reality. They're trying to soften it to make themselves feel better potentially.
Yeah. And I agree with you on the use of the phrase enslaved person, which, I mean, you and I are adults, and I think enslaved person has come into the lexicon fairly recently, at least into the general lexicon. And so we've been saying the word slave for decades, you know, so you're working yourself out of that well-ingrained habit. On a technical level,
the use of the word slave instead of a slave enslaved person is fewer syllables, and she was keeping herself to the exact length of the poem. So I see how that works.
Yeah.
As well. The other thing, and this is really kind of a wisecrack. God, how many ways does Homer have to describe sunrises?
Oh, yeah.
Dawn's always coming up and she's rosy fingered or pink cheeked or whatever. It just made me chuckle because it was one of the examples I used as like a Homeric epithet or whatever. And it was just kind of funny how I kept seeing it. I'm like, okay, this is really, really funny to me. So anyway.
Yeah. Someone had recently told me actually that with some of the colors that are used, because they kind of seem like, what is it, like a wine dark sea or something like that?
Yes, wine dark sea.
May have actually been because eyes at that time had not developed to see certain colors.
Oh, interesting.
And so I guess, you know, future or evolution of like cones and things like that. So some of this stuff. But all those epithets. You kind of get used to it, though. I do really like, or how she leaves her husband's bed, you know, which is like, I don't know if it had happened in this one, but it's certainly, I've seen it before that, you know, she gets up. But I like that it's like personified. Yeah. I feel like it's a very beautiful thing.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to start with just a little bit of questions about story and plot and story structures, but the meat of our discussion will be characters and theme. So the Iliad, correct me if I'm wrong, the Iliad does begin in the middle of the Trojan War, obviously, with the Trojan War mostly happening. But as far as his in medias res is concerned, it's mostly linear, right? Like it's kind of beginning, middle, end with a chronological structure, whereas this has a frame story in a sense, because 1 through 8 take place, one through four and five through eight take place simultaneously. We don't start with Odysseus leaving Troy. We start 10 years after that, 20 years after he left Ithaca, and we begin with 4 books about Telemachus. And then we do 4 books of Odysseus making his way to Phaeacia. Then there's 4 books of flashback, which is the Wanderings. And then 13 through 24 is just like, you know, again, 13, 14, 15 kind of simultaneous. And once Telemachus and Odysseus meet up, it's pretty much like linear from there. And I think that's much different than what we saw when we were reading the Iliad. Were you surprised by the structure, which is kind of sophisticated in a sense, if you think about it, especially for something this old?
Yeah, I think I wasn't surprised by the structure. I suppose initially because it's the Odyssey.
Yeah.
And even though obviously an Odyssey is, you know, something of its own, it's obviously a play off of the name of the lead. And so you would expect to, you know, encounter this man right at the beginning. But thinking about what he would have looked like, whether you did it at that time, which the first thing you would have seen of him on page 1, line 1, book 1 would have been him crying on a beach, which is not, you know, the most flattering presentations. Or you would have had like a rehash of something that had happened before, but instead we look at the family. And I think that I just want to warn everybody that I'm going to be laying into Odysseus on this episode. And I'll begin right now. So you might love Odysseus, so then in which case you'd be like, oh, there she goes again. I think a bad read is to always be like, woe is Odysseus, this poor man who can't get home. And we neglect, like, we forget about what was the impact of his decisions on other people. And not only the immediate people with him, his shipmates, his crewmates, his friends, also the people, probably his clients, if we think of him as a patron because he was a king, but his family. And to so to start with that and not only see the effect of not having Odysseus at home and then realizing why he's not, and having, I think, creating empathy for them, but also the effect of, because the Iliad was all about war, what's that like for the families that were left behind, you know, by the people who went to war? And I think that that is really big. So I think shocking when I initially read it, but as I, you know, have more depth in my understanding of the story as a whole, as well as reading literature, I have more appreciation for starting it in this way.
Yeah, I do too. I have a love-hate relationship with Odysseus. but I think that is really, really good. We'll get to that in a little bit because, like I've said, my 10th grade English teacher said the source of all great literature is moral ambiguity. Mm. And the fact that he is as Homer tells us in Wilson's translation, a complicated man. And so I don't have a hatred of him, yeah. But I don't have this sort of like, he's not like Achilles or Heracles or Jason or kind of the, he's way more human, I guess is the way to say it. And I think that was something that somebody told me that was kind of innovative for its time. I don't know if that's true or not, but yeah, I think the thing that I love about this as a story structure, taking away the characters and everything, is that I think it's sophisticated in a way that I didn't expect when I first read it. I think it really works well in literature. And I do tell my students that Homer invented the sequel in a sense, because this is a follow-up to the Iliad. And I, mm-hmm. when I think about sequels in film, especially, and even in series of books, there's certain rules that are followed or certain things that pop up, usually have things that recall the events of the first movie or book, right? And here we have things that recall the Trojan War, either through stories said by Menelaus or Pylos or the story that Demodocus tells about the horse, etc. Things that the people would have already known, but kind of catches us up on. There are familiar characters who appear even if they're not part of the plot, because in this case, this is kind of like a spin-off sequel. We take one person and we tell his story, as opposed to kind of getting together with all of the cast members. But we see Menelaus and we even see Agamemnon and Achilles down in the underworld, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's something, we're continuing things that were unresolved. And then there's something a lot of times that in a sequel, you're recalling things from the first movie and even working them into some of the plot elements. And I point out to my students that when the Trojan horse is told a couple of times, because it's what he's famous for, right? He was the architect of that strategy, mm-hmm. and led the soldiers in a big way. And he sneaks into Ithaca, essentially sneaks in disguised as a beggar. And when it's time to reveal himself at that moment, using the element of surprise, he does it. And I always tell my students, he's the Trojan horse. Like, he's doing exactly what he did in Troy, but he's the horse mm-hmm. this time. And what in all my years of reading this, I didn't pick this up until I was reading this time. When we get to Helen in book 3 or 4, I think it's 4, she has a conversation with Telemachus about the time she saw Odysseus in Troy. He had snuck into Troy to do some, you know, reconnaissance, et cetera, et cetera. And he was disguised as a beggar. And I never caught that Homer is foreshadowing that. I'm just like, this is freaking brilliant, because he sets up all these things that we still use as far as tropes and storytelling devices in our modern day storytelling. And I really, really love that about the way the book is structured. So book 24 ends with, like, you know, the suitor's family is about to take on Odysseus and his family, et cetera. And then Athena just comes down and is like, stop. Is this deus ex machina? Is it necessary? Is it something to be criticized? It kind of like is, because she goes to Zeus and Zeus is like, you have the power to do this, do it. And she does. And then everybody kind of is peaceful and she sticks around as mentor. I mean, it's kind of innocuous to me. I'm like, you know, whatever, it's kind of a weird resolution, but it's not that big of a deal to me. Did you find it kind of odd? Is it deus ex? Is it?
I do find it odd. I think if there were to be any argument for one of the claims that maybe it was multiple people writing this, I think this is part of like, they're not being in alignment. And you, of course, might disagree with me, but it, from the very beginning, is like told to us that these men are going to die in a horrific way. And Athena's good with it. And then all of a sudden, we're like told near the end that this is actually not a good thing, because like Zeus says that it's not going to be a good thing because he is breaking Xenia, mm-hmm. even though the suitors broke it first. So, I mean, I don't know if you can break an already broken thing, but he probably shouldn't have done it. But it's just interesting that like she's pushing for it. And then all of a sudden it's like, actually, this is pretty taboo. We need to stop this. And so I do find that to be something that seems a little bit wishy-washy in the, like, it doesn't make sense. Now, we could argue that, well, you know, the gods are sort of flippant in terms of like mortal things. And you know, Athena really loves Odysseus, so she probably is insulted on his behalf. But, you know, you do have to respect some of these mores that the gods sort of set out. So we could go with that. But it is a bit odd and, in my opinion, a bit inconsistent.
Yeah. That aside, let's get to the characters and let's get back to Odysseus. I find the idea that he is a complicated man pretty accurate. Like I said, he's a lot more human than, say, Beowulf, actually. You know, he's not... He's got, like... ability, not like superpowers, but like there are things he's very, very good at, and there are things that make him larger in life and places, especially to the people who haven't seen him in 20 years, you know, like some of the stories that are told. But I find him to be incredibly flawed, really aggravating at times, but I'm not rooting against him. And you, just if you want to expand how your feelings are on him.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this will probably be the third time I'll rant. So I ranted to Harry, ranted to Donovan. It's basically in terms of this movie, because I'm like, man, if they make this guy out to be an amazing person, I'm going to be so upset. So I think that he is a really engaging and interesting person. You have a question about, is he a hero?
Yeah.
I suppose that depends on what your definition is of heroism. From the Greek perspective, I think so. Mm-hmm. But in terms of anyone who might be under his leadership, as well as people against him, absolutely not. So it's like it's all about perspective. Because I think some people could, I think like Hector on both the Trojan and Greek side, they would say that that was a hero.
Yeah.
So just to be clear that I don't think it's always going to be like this, but I think only certain Greek, like the Greek leadership, would probably think that. But his men, maybe initially, but during the journey, they're like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
I do find him, I don't really likable. I'm going to say no. And engaging and likable, I think, are two different things. He is intelligent. I can see why Athena loves him. He does come up with great ideas. Even though I love the Trojans, Trojan horse was a great idea. Trojan should have listened to the priest who said, don't do it.
And Cassandra.
May she rest in peace. And the Polyphemus situation, you know, the blinding and then getting out under the, you know, so there are some like really clever things. However, a lot of the whole journey would not have happened if he had not done what he did.
Oh, he did it to himself. Yeah,
I know. And that's like the super leave it where it is. Even his men are like pulling at him, basically telling him to shut up. But he's got to have the last word, which is, you know, we know that is his fatal flaw, is hubris, really.
The arrogance, yeah.
Yeah. His constant lying, which again, you know, I guess that's the fraudulence. He's crafty, and I can see lying in circumstances where you really don't know what the situation is. But when he gets to Ithaca and all those lies that he has to quote unquote test people are super frustrating, because these people, it's not like his household, which are like, you can't be sure. We've got Eumaeus, who has been with his father, has been with him, has been loyal. Other people are saying that he stayed loyal. And yet you have this really tone deaf lie about being kidnapped and sold into slavery.
Yeah.
And then Eumaeus, who has like the exact same story, but it's actually real. Like, that's just awful. And then he goes, and then he has like a second lie or tale to other people. So all of those testings just get super annoying. And then there's also like, I spotted more like colonialism or like the hint of it, you know, where like, they're like, oh, this could be great. We could take all of this over, or sacking different towns. And in his lies, he talked about, well, he takes on, who is it? The pirates that he, 'cause there was like a stereotype of people. Was it the Cilicians? that he's Sicilian? That's what he kept, was that he kept saying it was the CIL.
Oh.
Wasn't it? Where he's like, I'm from this place. And that like people knew that these were like terrible people.
Yeah. He also says he's from Crete a number of times.
Oh, maybe that was the one. Yeah. And so, you know, there are certain stereotypes that are going along with it. Mm-hmm. Not being, I think, open and transparent with his crew. I don't know when or why that breakdown happened. And I know as a leader, you don't need to tell your people everything, but I think there are certain things you might need to. And I just keep referencing this when I talk to other people, the bag of wins is so frustrating because they were there. And the reason why they didn't get there to Ithaca is because he did not tell his men what was in the sack.
Yeah.
And so his men thought, oh, that he's hoarding gold from us and keeping from us. And I thought, oh my gosh, it was just like one conversation. It's like a classic romance miscommunication.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like one thing could have prevented it. So he's just really frustrating in a lot of ways. And I do have, I mean, you know, I don't want to belittle the fact that he is a man who's desperate to get home. And so I definitely feel for that. But he's also, he might be lonely, but he's never alone. And so mm-hmm. I also have to think about, you know, the warming of the bed by other women. And then, you know, having critique. I guess it was maybe less him than the shade of Agamemnon, but for other women who are like not doing the right thing.
Yeah.
He's like, well, Penelope better. And just like that comparison and that double standard, which is, it's tough because we got the context now versus then, but it is hard for me personally to like him. And this is coming from someone that like just read Achilles and, you know, all this stuff. And I don't know. Oh, so that's my long thing about my complicated feelings with Odysseus.
Yeah, I always point out the double standard to my students about Penelope and Circe and Calypso when it comes to Odysseus. You know, she has 100 men outside her door, and her biggest virtue is that she remains faithful, or at least that's how she's known for doing in some ways. And yet he has no problem, you know, sleeping with two demigoddesses, right? And we'll get to that a little bit more. But yeah, I see that. And I see a lot of the frustration. You know, the bag of wins is especially frustrating, but at the same time, and we'll talk about fate a little later, I think that's fate playing their part. The fates playing their part because he was asleep when they did it, but he could have told them. There are times where he could have saved himself, but again, his arrogance is his biggest flaw. And I see this in ways that like that's the lesson he has to learn, because you know when he's sailing away from Polyphemus, he starts trash talking him after this brilliant idea to not give away his name, right? No man. And then he's like, well, it's Odysseus who did it. It's like celebrating the touchdown on the 5-yard line, you know? I mean, you're like what are you doing, you idiot? And I always say he did this to himself, and then the curse happens, and then from there on out, yeah, everything that happens to him and his men is his fault. I think on some level he learns, maybe not that, but I think he learns like some humility, because Athena does not let up when it comes to him in the palace with the suitors. Like at one point or another, because they berate him, they throw a stool at him, they like really are all, because I mean, they're awful people. But Athena just kind of not only lets it happen, she kind of like pushes them a little more. It's almost like I want to say on some level, she's also kind of punishing him for the way that she, that he like disobeyed the gods and what he did. And it's like his lesson to learn is this humility, that your arrogance and your hubris are getting in your way. And I think on some level he learns that, but on some level he doesn't, which I think is why book 24, he starts a war again and she's like, all right, I'm stopping this by force, because he's still like pumped up, masculine, arrogant about it. I am also with you. I see times where the deception really works, like being the beggar, like not telling Penelope who he is, although I think in the back of my mind, she kind of knows, but revealing himself to Eurycleia. Well, Eurycleia figures it out, and then he's like, you have to keep your mouth shut, and she's loyal, eventually revealing himself to Eumaeus and Philodius because they're loyal. Like,
determining who he can trust. I think when the lies come, because I have to figure out if I can trust this person or these people, I think it's a really, really good strategy of his cleverness. But then there are other times, lying by omission or whatever. But I also think he learns a lesson here and there. Like, you know, his curiosity gets the better of him and they get to Polyphemus's cave, and that's how they get trapped. And you have the situation with the Cyclops, because the deceased wanted to go in the cave. But then with the sirens, again, his curiosity is getting the better of him. But this time around, he's like, put wax in your ears, tie me to the mast, do not listen to me. And it works. So I think he does learn those smaller lessons. And I think on some level, he recognizes some of his flaws. But also, I think he's still kind of arrogant at the end, because that's still this patriarchal society. And yeah, there's times where I'm just like screaming at him for being an idiot. And there are times where I do think he's a little bit more likable in places. I think in books like 13 through 17, there are moments, especially when he reunites with his son, in the moment with Argos and things like that, where I see the humanity in him. I do see a little bit of more emotion. And I think that works really, really well. But yeah, he's an engaging character, but he's not like... Superman or Steve Rogers or somebody who you like are really trying to identify with or see as a hero, see as an example. But you do want to see him. I do want to see him win in the end because of what's been happening to him. So moving on through Odysseus's family, we have Telemachus. Because Telemachus, like I always point out to my students, I draw this diagram, but there's literally three plots to this epic. And they all converge toward the end because you have Odysseus, you have Telemachus, and you have Penelope. And then, you know, like they meet and et cetera. And Telemachus's plot is a hero's journey, you know, the classic Joseph Campbell, you know, monomyth, where he leaves home on a quest and he comes back changed. And the idea here is that it's like he's going to learn about his father, but there's also like this journey into manhood for him because he's about 19, 20 years old. Why have Homer spend so much time with him? Because it's Odysseus's poem, right? So like, yeah. why the focus on Telemachus?
I guess beyond, if I'm to do another answer, just like the cost of war and what families are like.
Yeah, good.
I think there is maybe a smaller theme of fathers and sons. And obviously it's harder because the fathers and the sons are not here. But Laertes, I feel like, is kind of a specter throughout Odysseus's journey.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he's ever present in the web that Penelope is weaving. I suppose part of it is unfair because it seems like, and I wonder if this is just the patriarchy coming down there, that Telemachus feels like, and society feels like, with the father not at home, the son needs to step up and be the new man of the house, because Penelope,
that's classic patriarchy.
So I think part of it might be leaning into that. And what does that look like for a teenage young man to on the cusp of adulthood? He would have been in that term, he would have been an adult for a while, but just in, like for us, that's pretty young, just graduated high school, if you think about it. Yeah, what does that look like with someone who has not had a masculine role model, with the exception of Eumaeus, potentially? Because we don't really know. You can correct me. I don't feel like we didn't get too much background of, like, what was Laertes' presence like in his grandson's life?
Yeah, all I ever saw was that Anticlea in the Underworld mentions that Laertes has been in exile. So
yeah,
we can probably say that he, at least as of late, has not had much of a presence in his grandson's life.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and he might be like the most innocent characters. Maybe some things I like disagree with, especially with how he like dismisses his mother. But like he hasn't like any sort of big sins or crimes against him, and he's like just trying to do the right thing, and he feels like this bad stuff needs to go away, and so he's got to figure out how to do that. And so it's interesting to see sort of like a baby deer like stumble along, you know, and try to figure out what to do, how do I navigate this world going to these elders, being laughed at, you know, he cries at that, being disrespected by these suitors, and then starting to shock people because he, with obviously the provocation of Athena, but getting his own crew and like pushing back and be like, well, you know what, I will, and going on his own journey.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that he has like a parallel odyssey to his father and a parallel hero's journey. He gets to learn about his father because he would not have. I feel like this is similar to someone who may have lost, you know, a loved one, especially a parent early in life. You know, you want, you're eager for any sort of story. And so he's going to these places and these people that he knows, and he's growing from that. So it's almost a Bildungsroman, which we love here on Required Reading. I think father and son theme. And yeah, what does this look like for a young man in a male dominated society to grow up without a male mentor, and how does he sort of navigate that and become his own person? So I do find it interesting. I think the first time I read this and he starts crying at that meeting, I was like, what's going on? But I have like better understanding. I think there are, I do want to talk about all the crying, because I do have like some things against that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that, because it's in one emotion of my questions.
Yes. But I think overall, like, yeah, I very much appreciate his place in the story, because it'd be completely different to just focus on him, because then it would be like, well, yeah, his household, we don't even know, we don't even care what it was like without him. But this, I think, proves the opposite, that there were a lot of things happening while Odysseus was away, and I think he needs to own that. Some of it's not his fault.
You know, I think if an adaptation kind of pushes him aside and makes him kind of just a supporting character, and especially toward the end, it's doing him a little bit of a disservice, because I think his story is just as important. And you're right, the father thing is important, especially because everybody in Greek culture, they always introduce themselves as blank and blank son. So like, when Odysseus is revealed in book 9, reveals himself to the Ephesians in book 9, he says, I'm Laertes' son. So that idea that like, my father is absent, I am Odysseus' son. And then it's like, I have this huge legacy to live up to. And I think your point about metaphorically searching for somebody and trying to find who they are because they've been gone your whole life is important. In fact, the father and son thing is just interesting to me, because there are like several, you know, you have Odysseus and Telemachus and Laertes and Odysseus. And think about it. The only person killed in the fight in book 24 is Antinous's father, who was killed by Laertes, who is Odysseus's father. And Antinous, of course, is the head suitor. So there's that. Poseidon and Polyphemus, right? Like, you know, he calls upon his father to get the revenge. And then, you know, I mean, Zeus is the father of all the gods, and they're constantly going to Zeus and, you know, going to him. And then Orestes gets revenge. I mean, it's not shown, but Agamemnon's death is mentioned several times, and Orestes is the one who gets revenge. So this idea of father and son and legacy and what that responsibility is like weighs very, very heavily, and it weighs heavily on Telemachus. I think I don't like how dismissive he is to Penelope, or how even he just, there are points where he's like outright mean to her. And I wonder sometimes if that's him overcorrecting because he feels like he has to be a man. So there's that sort of like patriarchal dominance is the only word I can think of right now, where like, you know, she's a woman, so you have to treat her like a woman, even though she's your mother. Like, you know, so I'm not trying to excuse it, but I'm trying to think of like, maybe that's one of the reasons he acts like that, because he's trying to put on an act, or trying to, he's a little bit of imposter syndrome, right? And he's trying to get it out. But yes, he's so much a boy at the beginning of this, and you can see sort of a progression through that. As far as Penelope's concerned, I liked your point, by the way, about weaving, because there's so much women weaving. Mm-hmm. Because I think Circe and Calypso are shown at looms or one another. Just Penelope. I love the fact that she is smart. I love her deception of the suitors until she gets sold out by one of her own, you know, handmaidens, of weaving the thing and then unweaving it. And I do love how she doesn't let herself get led along, because her whole family is like, you have to marry somebody. I think even in
the Heroides, where she's mm-hmm. writing that letter to Ulysses. I think she's mentioning that her parents are pressuring her to marry the suitors, etc. I think she has some agency in the Odyssey. Not enough in my mind. I still think she's portrayed as like this grieving widow or the wife who's longing. But I did appreciate the fact that when Odysseus shows up at the end, she is the one who makes the decision about whether or not to actually welcome him back by giving him the tricking him with the whole set the bed outside the room thing. And he's like, I built the bed into the tree. You can't move it. And I think that her being the final arbiter of Odysseus's return does give her a little more agency than, say, somebody else who would have shown up. But at the same time, I see the frustration that is like Penelope just kind of a side character in many ways. I mean, how do you view her, or at least how Homer uses her, and how Wilson uses her?
I think Wilson might give her a little bit more space and nuance than mm-hmm. perhaps other translators have, which I appreciate. I think the greatest agency that she doesn't have is the ability to tell the suitors to leave. Because I feel like a lot of people on the outside might ask, you know, if this was such a big thing, why couldn't she do it? I just don't think she had the right to do it. I think if she did say, go away, that they would have been like, you're alone here, your husband's not here, this mm-hmm. is now, this is the way it's got to be, that sort of thing. So
she does that a couple of times too, and they're just like, no, we're staying.
Yeah So that is the unfortunate thing about being a woman in that time. Yes, I do think that she is clever. I also think that she knew that it was Odysseus and just went along with whatever was happening. Probably just like rolling her eyes at the whole thing and be like, well, we'll see what's going on.
See how this plays out. Yeah.
But I mean, the fact that the household didn't fall down, I think can only be attributed to her. Possibly. I mean, obviously mm-hmm. the enslaved people are doing the managing of the house and everything, but there's got to be someone sort of telling them what to do and preventing all of that and being sure that there is food, even though Telemachus hates that all the food is going away. Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, there's a reason why I think Odysseus chose her over Helen, because he was in that particular suitor battle, if people forget that. And
from the beginning of the Trojan, right before correct. The Trojan War, where Menelaus wins out. Yeah,
that's correct. Yeah, he came up with the idea that, well, what's going to happen is whoever chooses, everyone needs to make an oath that they'll accept it and they'll support. And then coming up with that plan sort of got him Penelope. And I think there's a reason why he chose her, because I think they sort of have comparable wits. Mm-hmm. As a woman who is, I mean, you know, we could probably talk to anybody who's had a spouse that's been in any war. That's hard to be away from someone. I mean, my sister-in-law, you know, my brother being in the Navy and being away, you know, it's a hard thing, especially if you are a single parent. So I think a lot of respect has to be given to Penelope. So yeah, I appreciate her portrayal. Like I said, I think the hand thing, which is just like, could be a throwaway line if you're not looking for it, I think speaks to her steadiness. I don't like how she's dismissed by her son, but I guess she mm-hmm. just takes it. I just feel like, man, don't talk to your mom like that. But overall, yeah, I mean, Penelope is the model for a lot of these, because it's really a dual representation of women, where you are either, you know, this loving wife, or you are this temptress slash witch slash, you know, something
seductress,
like that.
Yeah.
Correct. So, which is something that, you know, continues in literature, where you have, for Jane Eyre, you've got someone like Jane versus someone like Bertha. So it is interesting that she sort of started this particular archetype, and for good reason. And the weaving is just like a classic, classical thing, where, you know, a chaste woman, which is interesting giving that to people like Circe and Calypso. I think Homer, whoever has written it, is also pushing against ideas too. Mm-hmm. Because having someone weave, like if you died and on your little tombstone, the engraving was something like, you know, she's a good wife. She wove, like that was the best thing to get. Cause yeah. It's just this idea that you are the leader of the household. You're a chaste woman. You're doing what you should be doing. Society determined gender to be. So that from that, you can be like, yeah, Penelope was, she was amazing. MVP.
Nausicaa just does the laundry. although what's interesting is that yes. Because there's a point where and this kind of purity is not the best way to put it, but I'm the words escape me. This sort of purity or purity of thought or fidelity to her husband kind of is reflected in Nausicaa too, is that we can trust these women because of the way they view these sort of relationships. Because one of the things that Nausicaa does is tells Odysseus that he has to go back and through town on foot because she doesn't want people thinking that she is like sleeping with him or something. You know how the rumors mills yeah, go sure, and sure. stuff like that. So it's seen as like, okay, you can trust this woman Nausicaa because she's behaving like a proper woman should, in terms of that sort of binary view of the women versus, you know, the kind of the faithful wife versus the seductress. And let's just get into the two seductresses. You have Circe yeah. and you have Calypso. Is Homer giving us is there more nuance to the portrayal of women in this epic than, like, say, the binary, I guess the classic phrase is like the Madonna horror thing, like, you know, the kind of thing. Or is it that stark? I mean, I think that he gives it a little bit of nuance and there's a little more gray area than I think others might look at it. What's your opinion there?
Yes. Now I have to be really careful because mm-hmm. I love Circe by Madeline Miller. by the way, did I tell the audience that I got Madeline Miller to speak to my school?
I think you did. Why don't you tell them just a little bit about that and then get back to Circe?
I just want to give myself a pat on the back because at the moment, Madeline Miller is the most famous person in my phone. yes. Well, our school has a fund for speakers. There's a particular, it's like 1989 class, something, something, something. And it yeah. shifts between departments. So it's a foreign language department this year. And of course, you know, I am Latin versus like, there are these modern languages. And so I knew that they were going to have like a panel where their language is being used. And I'm like, you know what? I really want like an author and I'm just going to go, I'm going to shoot big for Madeline Miller
yeah.
and got it. Like it was amazing. We can't offer a lot of money. So she accepted the money and she doesn't do in-person anymore just because of a longstanding illness. But so we got Zoom. So Zoomed the whole school. And then she came in a second time during lunch, just in my classroom. But it was so amazing. I was nerding out, made a little joke about, she said, I hate snakes. And she's talking about that. And I was like, well, for good reason. I made like an Aeneid joke and she chuckled. And I was like, this is great. But anyways, I just like, it was so amazing to talk to her. She's so cool. So yes, I need to like separate myself from, you know, knowing things or, you know, a perception of who Circe is. I do think that there is more nuance because I think if they were just the Magdalene, what'd you say? The Madonna and the whore?
Yeah, isn't that one of those classic okay. Madonna whore, like, you know, Mary?
Whatever. Yeah. I think, the seductress or temptress, that it would just be all about sex. And she would just be like trying to, or both of them would be trying to keep them there, just to keep them there. And I think that with Circe, you know, turning, I love the fact that she turned some of his men and other men into
pigs.
Yes.
Is that the origin of the phrase?
No idea.
I know. I know mentor essentially comes from this, but
yeah, I feel like, It is believable from Madeline Miller's take that they probably, yeah, who wouldn't? You know, there's this whole thing about, would you, if you were in the woods, would you be rather be with a bear or a man?
Oh, yeah.
And women will typically choose the bear, because it's just more frightening to be with a man. And so just to think about that, she is this single woman who's probably very beautiful because she is a demigoddess. And these men are coming to her. So for her to have that agency, I just think is so amazing. But she isn't, in my opinion, a villain. You know, she gets outsmarted, not technically, I guess, because it is helped by Hermes, but, you know, Odysseus. And then she finds this, you know, sort of like human that she can have a conversation with. And then she helps him and she sends him on her way. So even though there was a sexual relationship, I feel like she wasn't keeping him there and ended up helping him in a certain sense, and also provided food afterwards and, you know, help change his men back. So I feel like there is more, because I think all of those things would not have happened if we just dialed her in as a one-dimensional person. It's a little trickier with Calypso because she is trying to keep him there, mm-hmm. though, and she kind of has to be ordered to release him. But I have empathy for her because she is similar to Odysseus. She's all by herself, and I think it very much, she wants to keep him there for like companionship. And offers, you know, well, I don't know how this would happen, but she does offer him, it seems like, everlasting life to a certain extent.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah, because she does say, like, all these other people, you know, they're going to die and all of that stuff. But she ends up, you know, helping him and letting him go. But it does seem like it's hard on her to do that. And so I think you see those, like, what is it like for, you get, I think, more feelings of a goddess being alone. That doesn't help anything to be forever living if you're alone. So I think there's like a depth there that you start to investigate these beings that seem otherworldly, and it seem like everything is good and they can have everything. That's not true for either of those characters. And so that, and the fact that they're also women and they still are sort of being pushed aside, I think does lend itself to more depth.
Yeah, I agree with you. I also like the moment where Calypso just lays into Hermes and calls out the male gods, because she's
yeah, you
like,
can do
look,
whatever you want.
You get all away with all this stuff. And when a woman does it, you're like really harsh on us, 100%. Which, oh, it doesn't happen at all in our society these days. Yeah. Right. You know, but no, again, I think it's one of the great points that I don't think I got out of anything that I hadn't read until I read this translation of it. And I was like, good for you, Calypso. I mean, yeah, she, and I like the idea that, yeah, she is lonely. She is keeping him trapped there, and they do have to force him out because fate has decreed that he gets home. Circe, I like, and I still have to read the Madeline Miller novel. I probably will soon after this. I got Song of Achilles for my birthday, by the way. And so I have to read those books, but I will get to them. But Circe to me is a lot more complex in the ways that you were talking about. Funny enough, my first encounter ever of Circe was in the Wonder Woman comics, the George Perez written Wonder Woman comics, because she, especially in the post-crisis era, is like one of Wonder Woman's like key adversaries, and she's played really well as a villainess. But anyway,
beautiful lady.
Yeah, but I think Circe, with the concept of Xenia, works really well. She sends him where he needs to be sent. Like, she ends up being a person who helps him along the way, despite the fact that at first she's an adversary. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there's two interpretations of this. Is one is this complex character, this person, you know, you can have empathy for her and et cetera. And I think the more patriarchal thing is that Odysseus won her, you know, or overtook her in that way, because he conquered her, like, you know, in the sexual way.
Because
Hermes is like, you got to wear the mori, whatever it's called, the root, because it's like, you know, this will make you immune to your spell, and then you have to sleep with her. And so he does that, and it's all of a sudden like he has taken her and et cetera. And I, you know, I don't feel it's like completely that way, but I do feel that there is a sort of like patriarchal, you're diffusing the powers of this woman with your manhood aspect to it.
What I find interesting too is, and I've seen this on TikTok, and it's been a few years, but I've seen a number of people insist that Circe and Calypso's seduction of Odysseus is sexual assault. I don't think I agree with that, because he has the agency that he does.
Who's saying this again?
The TikTok people and that sort of thing. I've seen it on the socials, and I'm just like, I don't really agree with that take, but it's a take I've seen, because I'm like, he does a lot of this in his own free will, and he knows what he has to do. I think it's unfair that Calypso keeps him, but it's more nuanced than that. And social media, especially TikTok, is not exactly known for its nuance.
I think it was fun for him in the beginning.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah.
And then we're getting on to the other main female character, who is Athena. What I find interesting is, and this is just kind of a point to make, and then we could just talk about like how you perceive Athena in this. In the Iliad, we see a lot of the gods on the battlefield. Like they mm-hmm. possess the body of somebody and they fight with each other. Here, they're in the background pulling strings, or they're side by side as a literal mentor. Mm-hmm. Or helping to guide, which is much, much different. I actually like that aspect of this, of that portrayal of the gods, of like them kind of being not on the foreground, but like they are where they have to be. I guess, and Athena herself is tricky, right? I think in some ways she's manipulating things in the same way. So she's showing those sort of characteristics of a woman. And I think it's important that Odysseus's champion on Olympus is a female god. I mean, she is the god of war and the god of wisdom, which are things he's both good at. But I think that's interesting. And I think it's important. How do you perceive Athena in the story? Heroic, not heroic, important, not important, you know?
Yeah. And may I also say that she's the goddess of weaving. So
weaving, okay, yeah.
Tie also to Penelope, but one would also call that obviously a female, like a feminine handicraft. And so I do wonder if you could almost see Odysseus as having masculine and some feminine qualities too.
Yeah.
Because of that patron goddess, and it, like he is like, in touch with his emotions because of all the crying, so it could be. I think what's nice about the Odyssey is that the Odyssey is like the whole thing with Athena is like if you were to take one character from the Iliad and extrapolate, you know, if you took maybe we'll say Paris, even though I don't like him, but he had the bows and arrows, you know, Paris, and then examine his relationship with Apollo. Yeah. So it's just nice to like pause and see what does this relationship look like. I like her presence. I mean, she is honestly my favorite goddess in the pantheon. So it's fun to have screen time with her. And I like how it's not just what she doesn't give Odysseus a get out of jail free card. He has to atone. But it's also interesting because if you know the background, you know that Athena and Poseidon have a rivalry with each other. Mm-hmm. So if she had done anything to help Odysseus get out of that, Poseidon would have been PO'd. That would have been really, really bad. And he probably would have gone to cry to his brother as well. So I'm glad that she allows some of this stuff to happen, but doesn't let it go too far. As I said before, I like that she's with the son as well and sort of helping. So it's nice that it's like from father to son, you know, I was his patron goddess. And so now I'm your patron goddess. Again, everything was seeded at the very beginning that, you know, the suitors were going to pay, they were going to die. And so I do find that a bit odd that she recognized, even though this was going to happen, she's pushing for it to happen. She also knows that it's like a sinful thing to happen.
Yeah.
So that is a bit confusing. But I suppose I guess she's trying to, I don't know, put things back in the status quo to a certain extent. But
I agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, but to what degree? Also with the weaving, it's hard to look at, you know, those 12 enslaved women and not remember Ariadne, who hanged herself after she lost competition, but then was turned into a spider. So that's also, you know, something that was in the back of my mind. But Yeah, I guess I mean, the simple answer is I like her and I appreciate her being in here.
Yeah, the violent end of the women, it is disturbing to me because the 12 slit girl, like, what he does remember is that he, after he kills all the suitors, he requests all of the women that had been with them, in other words, who had betrayed his family, clean up the mess, and then he has them hanged in public. So it's really, it's brutal.
It is brutal.
And so I'm like, that doesn't sit very well with me either. Because yeah, the ending is very, very violent, but that, I'm like, that's really cruel. And I don't know how to interpret that other than just, this is cruelty. I don't think he should have done that.
Yeah. And it's weird because I read it like a couple times, and what I got the sense was is that the noose was put around their neck while they were standing and then they were pulled up.
Yeah.
So just to have all of that happen. So like the wildest thing I'll say is that Melantho is maybe the one person that should have been punished in some way. I think this is still an extreme punishment. But what you just said is like they were quote unquote with them. I'm just thinking about, because I was just talking about this yesterday with someone, like World War II, France, Nazi officers inserting themselves into the household of women whose men were probably away fighting, right? Mm-hmm. And then those women just like being completely demeaned at, like their head shaved and like called whores and all of that stuff, when all of that was most likely not a consensual relationship. Like, what are you going to do? You're either going to let this Nazi officer in there or and be with you, or you're going to die. And I feel like, again, and we've talked about this with the Iliad, that these people are called quote unquote camp wives. How much is that consensual? How much is that not? And just like as an enslaved person, you have no rights, no say. And so there was just no grace given to any sort of those situations, which I think is pretty awful.
Well, and then there's that double standard of Odysseus doing what he does.
Yeah. Yep.
Because he really has no other choice in the matter, or like the situation demands it or whatever. And, you know, he's not strung up in that way, you know? So again, I think, you know, one of the things about the patriarchy is that it has a higher set of expectations and a higher bar to clear for women, especially if they're doing something that, for lack of a better phrase, that are things men do. Right. So like, you know, that are out of the like, you know, like with working or athletics or something, it's like they don't get, and people of color are the same way. It's really a white male thing, but they don't get as much grace or as many chances as, say, mediocre white men. And that's what frustrates me about this here, that like, you know, Odysseus really isn't. Odysseus is punished for pissing off Poseidon. But for some of the other things he does, he doesn't have real retribution. He gets his throne back. And so that's where that double standard comes in. So yeah, and like I said, I like Athena as well. Speaking of double standards in women in Greek history, Helen. So Helen makes an appearance. It's in book four. Helen. He goes to Telemachus, goes to see Menelaus and Helen. I think that here she seems more loyal to her husband and regretful of her role in the war. In fact, she outright says she was in Troy unwillingly. I think the phrase is like, they made my face their war or something like that. I know in other works, she's like branded like a Jezebel, right? Like there are some ways of portrayals of Helen, or she's often referred to as Helen of Troy, as really nasty and misogynistic. In fact, I once actually had to dress down a student who referred to her as a slut, or he might have referred to her as a whore. And I was like, first of all, you don't go around calling women sluts and whores. And I was like, second of all, she was taken against her will. Homer seems to be a little more sympathetic toward her, or actually has her be almost like redeems herself in a way, but I don't think she needs redemption. But there's definitely an idea in her mind of her role in everything and what she regrets. But I also think she shows, I mean, she's barely in it. She's in part of a book, but I think she also shows a little bit of strength and wisdom too, which is not what we always get from other portrayals of Helen. Is it consistent with the Iliad, and is Homer and Wilson extension correct in the way they portray her?
Yeah, this is interesting. So I will say that I read this scene earlier this year because I had been reading a book to do. My gosh, I still haven't recorded that podcast. It's been months. I read a 700-page book called Helen of Troy.
Really?
And I did not remember her going back with Menelaus. I didn't remember Telemachus going to visit her. And then it was mentioned, like, whatever this drugged drink was. And so I was like, let me go to the source material. And I read it. And frankly, part of me thinks that she's just living her life drugged up in order to make do with everything. And so that's why everything's pretty copacetic. That's a wild read. You can take that as you want. But I'm also just thinking, with everything that has gone on, she probably does blame herself for all of these countless deaths and a fall of a whole city, that probably I would also be numbing myself. And the fact that she can, like, make it so easy, I feel like it's there for a reason. And that says a lot. As for the portrayal, yeah, I guess it answers the question, right? It lays to rest from her mouth what had happened. Cause I think it is a question of, yeah, did she go willingly? Was it love, or was she taken? And so she says that, you know, she did not go willing. Though in that, was Menelaus right there?
He's there at points, and I think there's one or two points where she has Telemachus alone, but I'd have to go back and look through it. So
I just wonder, because I think that would also make the, because who's going to say, oh, I miss the love of my life, right next to the sky that she's right. So I you know, I always wonder, but chances are that she probably was taken, because that's just the typical thing. As for, yeah, I think characterization is pretty close. I'm glad she gets more screen time. And she was also saying, I mean, she was filled with regret during the Iliad, wishing that she had not been there, and spoke back to Aphrodite.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we can see that there were regrets, I think, overall. But yeah, my wild take is that she's drugged up at all times.
It's also 10 years down the road. The ancient Greeks did not have a definition of PTSD in any sort of sense. And you clearly would have a lot of mental health issues or things because of what happens to you, because it's a traumatic experience. So, but no, I agree with your take there. We're going to slide over to the male side of things, and I'm going to start with Agamemnon, because one of the things that his death comes up like 5 or 6 times, even when he's in the underworld talking to Odysseus about, like, how he died. And of course, we know the story is that his wife was seduced by, or was having an affair with Aegisthus, and Clytemnestra. Basically, they plotted to kill them. Then Orestes killed, you know, her lover. And in the end, when we see Agamemnon and Achilles in book 24, where the suitors' ghosts are parading, you know, doing their perp walk into the underworld. And they point out, they learn what happened, and Agamemnon's like, well, thank God Penelope wasn't like my wife. And it's just like, is it, I mean, what's the point? First of all, what's the point of bringing that up? Is it just to basically kind of shore up what Penelope has to, like, live up to? Also, like, why do they keep mentioning Agamemnon? Like, he keeps coming up.
He's the king of kings.
I guess so, you know? I mean, like, what's the special?
I don't know. Well, I mean, I obviously don't like him, but I think the fact that he would have been the lord over Odysseus, I think that's one thing, that it goes, all of these things that happened in the Iliad are, like, Agamemnon can be kind of a central figure for that. So I think they're just, yeah, tied to that, but also shows like what happens when you're away and you're a leader and what's going on in your household. So it's like an alternate universe sort of tale of, you know, what could potentially happen. But also, let me just say that Agamemnon takes Cassandra with him to be his mistress, is too delicate of a term, but basically, like, you know, forced sex slave, basically. Yeah. So, I mean, my gosh, Clytemnestra has a lot of stuff. Iphigenia was just the first thing, but to bring someone else home is just ridiculous. So, you know, just another of the double standard business. But yeah, I think it's that connection of that was his lord right there. And then it's, this is how it could be potentially. So I don't know if it's meant to spark maybe some paranoia in Odysseus.
Mm-hmm.
And then, oh, do you trust your wife? It's 8 o'clock. Do you know where your wife is?
Oh, the soap opera that. Yeah. It's interesting because we are getting into kind of the more masculine things. And you had a great point in that Odysseus and a number of his men, but especially Odysseus, cries quite a lot.
Oh, yes.
But then you have like the suitors who in my mind are like examples of paragons of toxic masculinity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They are like, you know, Antinous comes off as the alpha, so to speak. And they're everything we see these days in that manosphere idea, that they lay claim to a woman and property and these things, and they're arrogant and they pick on the weak in order to pump themselves up and strut around and peacock in front of one another. And in all honesty, I thought that the women being hanged in after the fight and cleaning up was cruel. What Odysseus and Telemachus do to these men, I am all for. Like, they are, that's the thing. Like, there was a criticism up there where they said she shows the suitors that they're sympathetic. I'm like, no, these men are disgusting. And when Odysseus finally reveals himself, I think it's a brilliant tactic to do it. He can completely by surprise. And I love the fact that they just slaughter them without dignity, because that's what they deserve. But maybe I'm being too harsh here, or my feminist nature is coming out. But like, you know, screw toxic masculinity. And I think that is I think this shows us an example of like, you know, how wrongly the idea of total patriarchal ideals and behavior of men is.
Okay, well, a lot to unpack there. So first of all, with the crying, so I was unsure why. I actually thought I was experiencing internal toxic masculinity because I was starting to get annoyed at all the tears. I was trying to figure out, oh my gosh, why is this annoying? Because typically I don't enjoy it. That's going to sound sick, but I like really appreciate when a man can like, you know, own his emotions and may tear up. But then I was thinking about, this is the reason why, because Oppenheimer, which is a super long film, I don't know if you saw it, there is one quote that has stuck with me. And it's when, I'm pretty sure after Oppenheimer's mistress either died or was killed, I don't know. It was kind of debated. His wife comes to him because he's like crying in the rain. And she says, you don't get to commit sin and then ask all of us to feel sorry for you when there are consequences. And that is like 100% what I felt. Because a lot of these people are like crying because of these situations that they caused. Now, some of it is like they really want to be home and they're homesick. And I totally get that. But there's one point where he, in one of his lies, is talking about how he and his crew went, it might have been a Cretan or a Cilician, went through a town and was like raping and pillaging. And he starts crying. And I'm thinking to myself, so this is definitely like some stuff that would have happened at Troy. And I just can't, like, you need to own that stuff and not be, you know, not be crying over these things that you have done. So that's part of the reasons I think I'm upset. But, you know, when people are like, eating holy cows and then getting upset when they were told explicitly not to eat the cows and start crying. I'm like, I don't have any sympathy for you because you did not listen.
Yeah.
Okay. So that, I just want to explain that. So the suitors. So it's funny because I may or may not be co-writing a restorative justice book, restorative justice in pop culture book, with a friend of mine. And so when I look at this, I'm like, wow, there's a major absence of restorative justice here. Which, just to give like a really quick thing, is not necessarily the absence of punishment, but you like don't immediately go there and you're looking at how can we like restore whatever the relationship was and repair the harms done. So clearly that's not happening. I do think I am going to go against Tom and feel like this is an extreme reaction. It feels like in this moment, I'm going to pronounce his name differently than you, that Odysseus becomes Polyphemus, because Odysseus initially, I would say, impinged on Xenia when they just started eating without permission in the cave. And then, you know, Polyphemus just starts to eat them. And so the suitors do that. And then Odysseus, it just seems like an overreaction of like, this is what you've done. Like, you have disrespected my household. You've disrespected me as a person. But does that equate to murder? Maybe. And I guess in that way, I'm just thinking like, Achilles got away with a lot for disrespecting Agamemnon.
True.
But he wasn't killed. Obviously, there was a reason why. But even that one guy, Thersites, remember him and how annoying he was? He would like be bashed about, but he was never killed. So I feel like where did this come from? It just seems so extreme. And when you extrapolate out, because this is all like a vacuum almost, like in this palace. But you don't think about until after everything's done and the fathers come in and they're like, those were our sons. You're like, oh, shoot, I wasn't thinking about that.
Yeah.
That they like cut off those lines. And you were talking about how it is so important to say, I'm blank, son of blank. And sons are so important to continue through those lines, that those fathers have lost all of that now. And who knows where their property is going to go. So like Odysseus has done. I just feel like it's an overreaction. Are there certain people that like Antinous? 100%. Now there was that critique, which I think it was that one. I don't know who was it, in your way before when you were talking about
the reactions to the translation.
The reaction, yeah. About like, is there sympathy? I will only say that there were. And this would have to be like, I'd have to do my own translation. There were moments of people who clearly were there, but were not adding to like the bad stuff that was like, they were not mistreating. It's, and you could only tell because there was a line of something like, this person did not add to this, but they were struck down. And obviously there's like symbolism, and you can think of like with nowadays, like, well, when you're silent, that means you're sort of also committing the action. But just to like compare those, like Antinous, who is actively doing all this, versus someone who's like, they're eating, he might be like, he maybe he feels uncomfortable, you know, speaking up, that sort of thing. But I do, it's a lot. It's I just think it's like, you need to calm down. So that's gonna be my time to go against you for this podcast episode, Tom.
I mean, I think there's something to be said about the fact that Odysseus is not like a feminist character in any sense of the word. There's still a lot of the patriarchy in him, and the, and him taking, him killing them is taking back what's rightfully his in that sense. I think there's a little bit less of a jerk in his character as opposed to say Antinous. I think that, and I just really was saying that because I see so many people these days, boys especially, who buy into people like Antinous, who are, yeah, just this caricature of a so-called man. But you're right, like the lack of responsibility, there are some lessons learned and some lessons that are not, or if they're learned, they're learned much later. It is restoring a status quo as well. So there's a lot more to it than, you know, good versus bad and those sorts of things. And I agree with a lot of your points. I still like the fact that they all got slaughtered. I'm not gonna take that away because I'm just like, sure. Yes.
And there's so much like food imagery. It's like, yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I really, and I like the way it's written too. I think some of the gore is written really, really well. I like the way that the poking Polyphemus in the eye is written. And, you know, again, just the vivid imagery of all that is really good. In terms of like, let's really quickly, I just have two more things I want to talk about. One is the concept of Xenia, which is hospitality. Yep. The other one is the role of fate. Let's start with the role of fate because I think we could have a little bit longer of a discussion about Xenia. So I always tell my students that the one thing that's more important or more powerful than any of the Greek gods is the fate or are the fates.
Yeah.
And we see it mostly in the part where he gets cursed by Polyphemus, the Cyclops, and Poseidon. He says, like, I don't want him to return home. I want him to die. And then he says, but if he has to return home, if fate decrees it, I want him to be alone. The crew's dead. There's trouble at home. And all of that has come to pass as we know it from the very beginning of the book. And I also consider the fact that Tiresias is the prophet he has to seek out another point about how important fate is, because people who know Greek stories know that Tiresias is the oracle in Oedipus's tale who warns him about, kill your father, marry your mother. And Oedipus thinks that he's like, I'm not going to be, everybody in that play tries to avoid fate and fate comes for them. And Tiresias is the prophet there who's warning about fate. So like that has to be deliberate on Homer's part. Like, here's the fate guy. And everybody would have known who Tiresias was, you know. Do you agree with the importance of fate? As like Homer says, do you think it's a good driving force for a lot of the explanation of some of the events of the story? I think it's giving us a pretty good idea as to some of the beliefs in Greek culture as well. What say you?
Yeah, to be honest, beyond that, what you said about Polyphemus there, I miss it as much. I feel like if it is there, it is more subtle. And I suppose I'm just so used to it in the Aeneid where it's like very much in your face.
Yeah.
And they're brought up so often. Even in the Iliad, I feel like there were conversations about this. By the way, his son's name was Sarpedon, which is going to
bother me
for a very long time. But yes, I mean, I agree with you that is the one thing that, the gods cannot, as well as swearing on the river Styx, but they can't stand against this. So what fate says goes. It's also interesting because I feel like Polyphemus killing Odysseus in that moment would have been a mercy. So it's always interesting that sometimes fate and it being dragged out can almost be worse than it just ending right away. Obviously his point is to get home, but just everything he went through I find very interesting. So what is he showing us about the importance of fate? Sort of like our just like, well, I guess it depends on your belief system, but our lot, there's already sort of a plan there. And the end point has already been somewhat determined, but it's kind of how you get there. And that it's not going to be a straight path. You were mentioning how you enjoy maps. And it's funny that there wasn't an included map to show his journey, because it's just like so ridiculous when you see the squiggly line.
Yeah, she shows you the locations, but she does not show you the path. And it's all sorts of crazy.
Yes. So I recommend looking that up, because he was so close, so easily, he could have gotten there. I'm afraid I don't have the best answer. So I'll give it back to you.
Yeah, no, I think it pops up a few times when something happens and somebody's like, this was prophesized, like the Phaeacians, right? They said, wait, somebody was going to come by and this was going to happen, and it happened, and those sorts of things. And I think that I think it's a good way to explain certain events or certain mistakes that are made, too. I don't think it let Odysseus off the hook for his actions. But at the same time, like I said, with them seeing the shores of Ithaca and then opening the bag of winds, that's clearly fate is working against
Odysseus because of what's been decreed and things like that. But I always find that interesting, especially when people get into those situations and they're trying to avoid said fate, and it always comes back to them. With the case of Odysseus, I don't think he knows what his fate is supposed to be. So we're seeing him be kind of led along with these threads and seeing the mistakes that are made, but also like we're sitting there going like, no, take personal responsibility. I don't care if you're fated for it. It's going to happen, but you have to recognize your role in it. So there's a kind of a discussion to have about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So one last topic, which is the concept of Xenia, which is hospitality. And the idea of Xenia is that you take in foreigners or visitors without knowing who they are. Wilson wrote that beautiful paragraph at the end about the foreigner coming to your door. You don't know who he is, but you take him in and give him food and give him drink, and you throw the party anyway. And it's huge in this story. You were mentioning how both, you know, Odysseus starts stealing the food and Polyphemus is like, well, I don't really care about your customs anyway. And you know, I'm going to eat your men. But then there's like, there's the Phaeacians. There's the fact that Penelope, Telemachus feel bound to house the suitors because of that custom. Like, what are the good sides and the bad sides of Xenia and how it is portrayed, or how Xenia is portrayed in the Odyssey?
Yeah, well, anyone that Telemachus went, I mean, they were shoving food down that little kid's throat.
I know.
And one of them, I mean, it's pretty funny when he turned to his friend and is like, hey, I've got to get back to this ship, because if I go to your dad, he's going to keep me there for a long time.
Yeah.
But that's just, I mean, what a blessing that, you know, he was welcomed. And then Odysseus really trying to beg off of, the Phaeacians, right? Nausicaa's people. Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. And how much like they keep wanting to hold him and listen to his stories and feed him and everything. Mm-hmm. I love that Xenia is hereditary. So you have this bond. So you personally might be a stranger, but you mention like our parents or our forefathers were, you know, had a guest host relationship, and that immediately enters you into that relationship, which I find very beautiful. I think the stereotype would be if anyone's not following this, then, you know, they're clearly uncivilized by barbarians.
Mm-hmm.
And was there anything else about this? Why is this so important? The good and bad sides of it. Well, anyone can abuse that hospitality, because you can be a kind person offering that, and then I think like the suitors, they abuse that. They should have left after the first night potentially, or the first few. I don't know how there's that much food in the stores.
I know, right?
It just boggles the mind how much they must be slaughtering. I think the danger is being taken advantage of or being murdered, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, if you saw Supergirl, did you see Supergirl?
Not yet.
Oh, okay. Well, just the beginning. Okay. Yeah. I mean, he kind of bursts in. It's not like he was welcomed, but, you know, they gave him some pie, and then it turned badly. So that those are clearly the dangers. But the fact that it continues on, but then there's a responsibility. So if our fathers had this, then we should also have this. So you can't really beg off. And I think there's obviously a fear of the gods in this, and of fate, if you want that too. And, you know, there's this aged couple, Bacchus and Philemon, that Zeus went to visit it. This was not just an aside, as like this, as a homeless person, probably as this beggar, and they welcome him in there because it was a test. And they passed. So he gave them, when they died, he turned them into trees so they could be together forever. So you just don't know. It's like, you don't know who you're welcoming in the Christian worldview. You're always supposed to look at this person as like, that could be Jesus, you know, that's on the street. Are you going to help that person? That sort of thing. So there you go.
Which is, again, it seems like a through line from, you know, the Greek custom of letting people in, and all the people who let people in and treat them well in this story are quote unquote the good guys, right? Eumaeus, for instance, you know, letting this random beggar in, and, you know, he doesn't know it's Odysseus. So this is just the display of custom to remind people that, you know, we do take foreign people in. And I think that can be extended to, like, you know, we were talking earlier, the very beginning of this long episode, about our current society and the way there is this culture war of sorts going on about immigration. It's been immigrants and migrants, and it's been going on, like, you know, for many years, but now it's been intensified over the last few years, especially with, like, raids by ICE and things.
Yeah.
The moral imperative you have is to take people in, is to help them if they need help, or what you do what you can, I guess, is one of the better ways to put it. I mean, we literally have the Statue of Liberty with Emma Lazarus's poem of "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free." That's not a platitude. You know, it's a mission. And I think that, you know, we see this in this ancient text. It's been part of humanity for so long. And I think that's one of the cooler things about the Odyssey, of how we can take what were very, very ancient ideas and customs and apply them here and debate them, discuss them, and see this through different lenses. Now, I guess my question is, because we've had this discussion about viewing old works through a modern lens, where's the mean? Where's the golden mean of understanding the concept of the society in which this was? Because we talk about, like, the patriarchy, for instance, it's a very patriarchal society. So I may not agree with anything Odysseus does or what he does with that regard, but I comprehend it. You know, I comprehend the reasons because I comprehend the society, but at the same time, I do want to look at this and see it through. I don't want to dismiss a modern lens completely. So there's gotta be a middle part somewhere in that gray area. I'm not exactly sure where that is. I think it might be in that we have to take into consideration what everything was like, where they were, and the customs, and understand them before we start criticizing them. But as I always say, I don't want to outright dismiss this or a character or something because I have a different perspective and different political leanings or cultural leanings or something like that, because I'm not in ancient Greece. So, I mean, how do you interpret what the mean might be?
Of Xenia in particular?
Oh, no, just looking at the Odyssey through the modern lens versus, you know, understanding, well, this is how it was.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah, so I think understanding the context is always key to this, because you can't read it inside of a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe the mean comes into, you know, being able to push back on some of the ideas and say, like, as you were saying, you know, this is how it was, and ask questions of, like, how have things changed and how might this sort of chafe against what we currently do. I don't think we should completely dismiss things just because that's not how we do it now, but we can see, like, oh, how is this problematic now, looking back. But yeah, I just feel like it lends for bad reads or disingenuous reads if we just dismiss some of these, because this is not the way our culture is. And that's where empathy comes from, right? Is you might disagree with a lot of stuff that went on or representations of these people, but, you know, you have to extend your understanding of where were these, what was life like back then? What would these authors, these writers or writer, what would that mindset have been like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, cool. So one more question. It's always our last question. Is this required reading?
Oh, Tom. And I will say, I did see that there is loyalty and fidelity. And I mean, one of the most beautiful moments is when that dog.
Oh, yes. I should
have. Is waiting 20 years for his master to come back. His master, who is in fact looking like a beggar. And probably how he should actually look. And sniffs him, or, like, you know, recognizes him, and then dies. So very beautiful moment.
The clip that I show when we read that story in ninth grade is it's from the very end of an episode of Futurama where Fry was going to clone, found the kind of preserved corpse of his dog, and they were going to extract the DNA and clone him, and then he stops the cloning. He's like, he lived for a number of years. He probably had a great life. And then the end credits is basically years and years and years of this dog sitting outside the pizza parlor where Fry worked waiting for him to come back. And it's gutting. Like, the kids are always like, this is so sad. Yeah. So, and I apologize for not mentioning that. I was like, yeah, that's to me, that's one of the most poignant parts of the entire story.
Absolutely. Harry, he makes a lot of bad jokes. And yesterday, when I was expressing my like worry about the film, he said, well, what if it ends with Linkin Park, What I've Done? And I was like, sure. Because have you seen any of this? Of like, people are like, what a movie would be like if it was, who is that director? Michael Mann? No, not Michael Mann. The guy who did Transformers? Yes, Michael Bay. And you know, you're like, normally they look in at like a cat and then What I've Done, and then the cat wakes up, you know, that sort of thing. And I said, well, if they do it, it's going to be after credit scene and they're going to zoom in on the dog and you thought the dog was dead, and then they've got What I've Done, and then the dog awakens. So it won't actually happen. I'm just kidding. But I do think that this is required reading, actually. It's something that my school does not do, which I think is bad. If I ever find myself in need of more classes, I'm sort of the first call to have the Odyssey to teach it. But I just think that it needs to be, I mean, I love the Iliad, but I think this one might be easier, and because just so many battles that people get bored. I think this one's easier in terms of like storytelling and a narrative that keeps people, students engaged.
Yeah.
But I think it's very important, especially in this literacy crisis we now find ourselves in, that there is some piece of classical literature and an epic. And this is such an origin point for Western literature and action adventure stories and things like that, with all these themes that we're talking about, that it's super important for students to engage in this.
I could not have put that better than myself. I mean, honestly, I wholeheartedly agree with that. It is required reading, and especially Wilson's translation. I absolutely love this, and I will. And if anybody asks me about, should I read the Odyssey, I will easily recommend this like 100%. So yeah. All right. So we do have one small piece of feedback before we get to close out the episode. It's from Michael Bailey, who messaged us via Facebook and was talking about our episode about Flowers in the Attic. And he said, listening to your episode about Flowers in the Attic, which brings up memories of the movie being on HBO hourly at one point, and the messed up books my friends read in high school. A lot of them looked at this one and said, hold my beer. So I thought that was funny, because like I said in the episode, my generation just has this. We all read inappropriate books at various ages, and it was, yeah. So anyway, this has been a very long episode. And for those of you who have made
it
to
the epic?
Oh, it was epic. It was an epic poem of an episode. Those of you guys who have made it to the end, really appreciate you sticking around. In a couple of weeks, the next episode of Pop Culture Affidavit will drop, and that will be a discussion between the two of us about the Christopher Nolan movie. That's a 3-hour movie. I'm not intending to make it a 3-hour episode. But come back for that. In the meantime, you're going to do all the things about leaving us feedback and telling me how damn long my synopsis was. But before we go, Stella, what is our next book?
Yeah, I'm super excited to completely switch on the gender spectrum and have a lot of controversial things in terms of gender stereotypes again, but in a completely different way. This book's been making its rounds. People hate it. People love it. People don't understand that it's satire.
Shocking on that.
I know, seriously. I can't wait to talk about this wild book. It is so wild. It's called Yesteryear by Caro Claire Burke.
All right. So come back for that. And as always, thank you very much for listening, and take care.
And remember, if you have a very important piece of, I don't know, information, luggage, you should probably share that with your companions so that things don't get out of control because they think you're hiding something.
Words to live by. Good night.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.